Good morning, folks. We are not going to
officially
dabble in at this point because we don't have a quorum, but we're anticipating that we'll have a quorum in the next couple minutes. So what I'd like to do is I'd like to get conversation started with our first bill on the agenda, which is House File 1500. And if I could have the author come up and talk a little bit about the bill. I want to remind folks that this bill is in this committee because of a couple sections. One is in section 7, and it's on page 6, line 629 through 6.31, that speaks to the marking of not for voting. And it also appears on page 8, lines 8.4 through 8.6. So we're going to combine hopefully the testimony as well as the questions specific to this, because this is a pretty significant and large bill, but it's only here in our committee because of those two sections. So, what's that? Oh, I'm sorry. Article 3 also addresses elections generally in general. So, welcome the chief author. Representative Wincourt, please start to present your bill, and we'll move it once we get a quorum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 1500 is the driver's license for all bill, or freedom to drive. It has various names. And the purpose of the bill is to reestablish the driver's license rules that we had in Minnesota before 2003. Before 2003, it was not necessary to demonstrate to the Department of Public Safety in Minnesota that you had status or lawful status in Minnesota in order to get a driver's license. The driver's license was primarily for the purpose of ensuring that our roadways are safe, that our state troopers and police could identify a person based on their license when they were pulled over, to make sure that people have auto insurance when they're driving, and to protect the public safety of our roadways in general. That was the purpose of the driver's license. This bill restores that. In 2003, a regulatory change was made to require status to be demonstrated in order to get a license in Minnesota. And since that time, Minnesota has become compliant with real ID standards that the federal government has required of us. So the bill before us does not change real ID compliant licenses. It does not change enhanced driver's licenses, which we still have in Minnesota. This is strictly for driver's licenses that are not compliant with the real ID or enhanced driver's license status. And the reason this bill is before us and why there is, or before you, and why there is a an amendment today is because there are concerns that in making this change, expressed by some, that this could in some way compromise our election integrity by not having it clearly marked on the license that the ID tied to a person without status is somehow going to create a voting right that wouldn't otherwise not be available.
Thank you for coming short, and we will get back to you. We do have a quorum now, so I will call this meeting to order. And Representative Winkler, we'll move House File 1500, and where this is going next?
Committee on Government Operations.
Okay, so we will we refer this to Committee on Government Operations, and I believe you have an author's amendment.
Mr. Chair, you should have the A8.
I will also move that. If you can speak to the amendment, and we'll get the bill in the shape in which you want that.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Your motion is in good time, because I was just going to get to what changes we're making in non-compliant driver's licenses in this bill, and in particular in this amendment. And so what this, under current law, if you have temporary status and you have applied, I'm not sure what date since, but if you've applied since at least 2003 for a driver's license, your driver's license will have a marker on it indicating that it is temporary or requires, which is, it used to say status check, but the point is it's temporary. because your status is temporary. What this bill will do, and because we're not checking status, for any, and this is under as amended, anybody who applies for a Minnesota driver's license and does not present proof of citizenship will have a marker on the back of the driver's license that says not for voting. Election judges will be trained to look at the back if people present a driver's license for purpose of registration at the polls. And if it says not for voting on the back, that means that you are not a U.S. citizen and therefore not eligible to register. And so if you look at the amendment lines 1.14 to 1.21 and look at where that is inserted on page 6, lines 6.29 and 6.31, and then following in 3.2, you'll see where we're inserting this change. And so if you are concerned about election integrity and you're concerned that non-citizens could decide to start voting in Minnesota, this bill, as amended, will actually enhance your confidence in our system because it will ensure that people who apply for a driver's license and do not demonstrate citizenship will have a marker on the back that says not for voting, whereas under current law it doesn't indicate with those words that a person is not eligible. And so so that's important. But I think equally important in this bill, we are making sure that the voting issue is not used as an excuse for not providing a driver's license to undocumented immigrants, which, as I've said, is critical for our public safety. And I think if you take testimony today, you will find out, and if you don't know already, just how critical it is to the lives of so many Minnesotans. People in 12 states already have the right to get a driver's license. The states represent a quarter of the U.S. population. So this is something that is good for public safety. It is good for our immigrant community. It is well within the norm in the U.S. to do this. And that's why we have support from business groups, including the Chamber of Commerce, Hospitality Minnesota, AgriGrove Council. It is why the Catholic Conference supports this bill, and why individuals in law enforcement have supported it as well. So, Mr. Chair, I would ask for favorable consideration on the A8, specifically on the voting issues.
Thank you, Representative Winkler, and I see you have your co-author, Representative Gomez. Representative, would you like to say a few words?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for hearing this bill and for helping us move it quickly. This is a really a really crucial issue to a lot of our neighbors, a lot of people in Minnesota.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. Are we still speaking to the amendment right now?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, we have not. Thank you. you spoke to the amendment. I will move the adoption of the amendment. If you have some questions, now would be a good time. Representative New.
Excellent. Thank you, Chair Dean. And I just have one question about the amendment. And Chair Dean, your comments opening up today, I think, were very relevant, that today we're talking about the sections of the bill that very specifically relate to elections. And clearly, the first part of this amendment do relate to elections. And so I'm just wondering, Mr. Majority Leader, why the rest of this amendment is being amended in elections. Would that not be more appropriately done in another committee?
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative New, we do have an additional amendment that I think will be better suited for government operations. These are primarily conforming changes to the elections provisions and expanding the, for example, in Section 6, expanding the non-discrimination provisions to apply to those who don't prove citizenship. The point being, we are changing, and so we want to include all of the relevant sections that will be changed by the standard that we're adopting here, which is for the purposes of making clear who the not-for-voting mark applies to, but then leads to making sure that we are not creating a situation in which Minnesotans who don't have status can claim non-discrimination, but Minnesotans who do have status but still have the not-for-voting marker on there couldn't claim a discriminatory action, or bring an action for discrimination. So it really does kind of all fit together in this amendment. And we will have an additional amendment on a different section of government operations. So we did try to keep it just to this changes, these set of changes.
Thank you, Representative New. So
it's readopted.
So all members in favor of actually adopting the A8 amendment, incorporating it, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? Okay, now it's completely in the shape that you want it. And Representative Gomez, if you'd like to speak briefly, and then I know we have a few testifiers, and I'd like to try to move on from this bill within the next probably 20 to 30 minutes at most. Representative Gomez.
I'll be very brief then. I just wanted to highlight that nothing in this bill changes anything about the way that we evaluate voting eligibility in the state of Minnesota. All of those functions remain in place. There are people, as Representative Winkler pointed out, who currently hold Minnesota driver's licenses or identification cards who are not eligible to vote, and we have systems in place to ensure that they're not using them to vote. And so this will just be kind of in line with the way things are happening today. So again, I thank you for your consideration of the bill.
Okay, thank you. First testifier on the list is Secretary of State Steve Simon. If you could come forward, I know he has to be six places at one time today, as many of us do. So if folks see people running in and out and things like that, it's because we have several committees going on and we have lots of bills that individuals are going to have to testify. So please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Steve Simon, Minnesota Secretary of State. I'll be quick, and I'll limit my remarks to the elections-related provisions. That's why I've been asked to participate. I want to thank Representative Winkler, Representative Gomez for bringing this bill forward. From my office's perspective, this bill has really very little to do with elections. It would not alter the process, as you've heard, of Election Day registration or put our elections at risk. Election judges already search for indications on a driver's license that the person before them may not be a U.S. citizen. They search for those words status check or temporary on a driver's license. We work very closely with the Department of Public Safety on that aspect of it and filtering and screening voter registrations with multiple databases right now. So this is work that they already do, but instead of looking for status check or temporary, election judges would now look for the very clear words, not for voting. It would actually say that, not for voting on the driver's license, which to me seems even more explicit. It's not subject to much interpretation. Not for voting means not for voting. So this is work that election judges are already doing, and I would say that the new language is really an improvement for those reasons. Non-citizens, documented non-citizens, already receive driver's licenses in Minnesota. My mother was never a U.S. citizen. She was a citizen of Austria. So she always, her entire life here, decades, had a driver's license. But obviously she couldn't vote. But there was no indication at that time that she wasn't a citizen. She's been gone for a while now, but there was never anything on her driver's license. Now we have either status check or temporary. With this bill, were she still here, it would say explicitly not for voting. So it's even better than the regime that we've had for decades and decades. So I'm happy to answer any questions from members, but from our office's perspective, this bill has very little impact on Minnesota's elections. They will just be as secure, I would argue even more secure, than they were before. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Any questions? Yes, Representative New.
Thank you, Chair Dean. And actually, just a comment, Mr. Secretary, thank you for your comments. And I agree that checking driver's licenses would be a really great practice to check for eligibility requirements.
Thank you, Representative. Seeing no other questions, I'll move on to our next testifier. And good luck getting through all the committee hearings you need to get through, Mr. Secretary. So, Reverend O.B. Ballinger, please come forward, state your name for the record, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Dean. Good morning. I'm the Reverend O.B. Ballinger. I serve as pastor of Edina Morningside Community Church, a congregation of the United Church of Christ in the Edina area. In my ministry, I've seen the grief and loss caused when a driver's license is taken away. Without a license, one person in my church has had to settle for the minimum wage job that's within walking distance. Another's lost the freedom to attend worship or get groceries independently. Children become chaperones as their parents talk about the loss of dignity that comes without a license. None of these people are new to Minnesota. But theirs is the experience of any immigrant who was here when driver's licenses were taken away, causing untold grief, job loss, and harm to human dignity. We start worship in my church every Sunday by saying, no matter who you are or where you are on life's journey, you are welcome here. We do so not because it's a politically correct, warm and fuzzy thing to say. We do so because the God we follow and serve has made all people welcome, has made us welcome, and has called us to offer that welcome to every person in Christ's name. Like Jesus, we believe each person is made in the image of God with creativity, purpose, and joy, regardless of what they look like, where they were born, or what boundaries they have crossed or stayed within. Indeed, our Savior challenged fearful customs that denied God's image in others by denying them health, dignity, and safety. He healed on the Sabbath, ate with the disrespected, spoke with outcasts, and cared for those who were not like him. Christ taught us that the greatest commandment, the purpose of all the other laws, is to love God and love your neighbor as yourself. It's past time to restore the right to drive to immigrants who bear the image of God just as you and I do. The current law must change so that the higher law of honoring God's image in every person can be fulfilled. No matter who you are or where you are on life's journey, you are welcome here. God has made it so. Let us follow. Thank you. Did I hear an amen?
Yeah, I did.
Yes!
Thank you, Reverend, and thank you for the amen. We'll try to keep the committee a little bit low-key today, and if members from the public could refrain from exhibition of excitement, that would help us go a little bit faster today. So thank you, and any questions for Reverend Ballinger? Okay, with no questions, we'll move on to our next testifier, Grace, and I'm going to not even try to say your last name. If you could come on down and state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Chair Dean and committee members, my name is Grace Wakarowicz, and I am the Director of Elections and Voter Services for the City of Minneapolis. I have over 25 years of experience in election administration. I'm a certified elections and registration administrator through the Election Center, which is a national organization of election officials and a member of the League of Minnesota Cities Elections Task Force. My interaction and collaboration with the state and nationally provide me with the confidence to address House File 1500 relative to election administration. The provisions and safeguards established in this bill are consistent with the existing protocols that validate voter eligibility and ensures the integrity of the election. Through the statewide voter registration system, SVRS, registrations go through a series of electronic validation checks with several agencies to verify eligibility: Driver and Vehicle Services, Social Security, USPS, and vital records are among some of the examples. Relative to driver's license and ID cards, relevant data points are checked, including the type of documentation submitted. For example, the type of documentation submitted with a passport and an I-9 form is submitted on the license card and previously, prior to this, a status check notation denoting that that it is valid to the date of that is listed on the I-9. The status check notation flags the voter registration that it may be deficient to prove voter eligibility. This in turn generates SVRS to confirm eligibility by other means that can include a challenge on the voter record and noted as such on Election Day roster. Challenge notations require the election judge to clear the challenge. The voter must provide specific information as requested to certify eligibility before that ballot is cast. Non-compliant licenses and IDs will have the same eligibility certification process. Not for voting is comparable to the status check notation. Election judges also receive comprehensive training on registration. First and foremost, the registration application requires the applicant's signature to certify under penalty of law that they are eligible to vote and all requirements are met. The list of registration documents is clear and concise to minimize error. Commonly trained as, if it's not on the list, it can't be used. Visuals are also used to identify the components on the document that can be used to certify eligibility, including components that are not, such as a status check on a license or ID card. The head judge who manages the polls receives additional training on how to clear all challenge notations. Ultimately, every jurisdiction throughout the state trains. If you do not know or if you are unsure, call us. Finally, I am confident that the integrity of the election will continue with the passage of House File 1500. Established provisions do safeguard against potential voter fraud. As the third largest electoral jurisdiction, voter violations are very rare. All potential voter violations must be investigated by law enforcement in each local jurisdiction. For the 2016 presidential, the 2017 municipal, and the 2018 gubernatorial elections, referred to us through February 25th of this year, there were zero investigations of a non-citizen attempting to vote. Referrals on non-citizens attempting to register was 3 in 2016, 6 in 2017, and 4 so far in 2018. That is a total of 13 out of 378 referrals to investigate, of which 11 were closed as unfounded and 2 are still open. They're still being investigated. Therefore, on behalf of the City of Minneapolis, I firmly support House File 1500. Passage of this bill will not negatively impact the integrity or the administration of the elections. Chair Dean and members of the Congress, thank you for the opportunity to speak on behalf of House File 1500. I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Ms. Rocklow.
Rocklow-Rowitz. Grace is fine.
Okay. Ms. Rocklow-Rowitz. Any questions for the testifier? Seeing none, I want to thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
And that completes our list of people that have signed up. I'm going to actually open this up to testimony from the public, and I will limit it at 2 minutes. And I would like the testimony to be related to the elections portion of the bill. So are there any members of the public who would like to speak today? If not, we will then move on to questions for the bill author. Any questions for the bill author? Seeing no questions, I will renew your motion for House File 1500 to be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations. As amended. So all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. You're on way to government operations.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, and thank you for your discussion this morning.
Okay, I have a bill up, so I'm going to have to turn the gavel over to Vice Chair. You could take over.
So we're saying I don't want to vote for it. It's the beauty of it, right?
estamos aquí un poquito felices, gracias a Dios, de pasar otra vez la cuarta audiencia, y pues están aquí, creo que les voy a presentar a las personas que estuvieron aquí en el Capitolio. La verdad, yo me siento muy contenta, muy feliz, a veces está con ganas de, pues de llorar, ¿verdad? Porque puede uno, pero tenemos que ser fuerte.
Okay. All right. If we could have some quiet from the audience so that we can go ahead and move on. Chair Dean, it looks like we have House File 1603. Would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair. I would like to move this bill for... Mr. Gehring, what am I moving this for? Is it to re-refer to Committee on Government Operations, or is it to lay it over for possible inclusion?
Mr. Chair, I believe you're intending to lay it over for possible inclusion.
That's what I thought, but I just wanted to make sure, and that's why I thought I would ask you. Thank you, Mr. Gehring. So I'd like to move 1603 to be lay over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill.
Thank you, Chair Dean. Then we will go ahead and let the record reflect that Chair Dean is requesting to move this House File 1603 for possible inclusion. Go ahead, Chair Dean. And
thank you, Madam Chair and members. This bill is very, 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 very similar to a bill that we laid over previously for inclusion. It involves the expansion of townships for mail balloting within the seven-county metro area for those townships that have fewer than 400 registered voters. So I want to thank the committee for allowing me to present this to you today. And if there's any questions, I'm happy to take them at this time. Yes.
Representative News.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Chair Dean, is there a Senate companion to this bill?
I believe there is, and I don't know what the number. Oh, to this bill?
Yes.
No, there's Senate companion to a similar bill.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Any other members, any other questions for Chair Dean? Are there any members from the audience who wish to testify on this particular bill? If you want to please come forward. Sit in the chair and state your name for the record and your position.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Thank you. My name is Andy Loken, and I am the Elections Director for Dakota County. And I'm here to speak on behalf of Dakota County and the Minnesota Association of County Officers in support of House File 1603. Lifting the exclusion that exists for cities under 400 voters and townships of any size in the metropolitan area would provide a cost-effective and efficient method of voting for these communities. Three cities in Dakota County, Coates, Meesville, and New Trier, currently utilize Minnesota Statute 204B.45 as it is currently written. Passage of this bill would increase that total to 18. In Dakota County, that would involve 11,669 voters. The three cities that utilize it, mail balloting as it's currently written, have done so in four elections so far, beginning in 2016. Turnout has not been impacted negatively. In fact, in the case of state primaries, it may have increased slightly. As I've mentioned in other testimony to this committee, voting equipment in this county costs a municipality about $6,000 per precinct to purchase. It also costs about $616 per precinct annually for licensing, maintenance, and other fees. Consider the cost per taxpayer in a city like Randolph with 267 voters, or Hampton with 387. In addition to the voting equipment costs, these municipalities must provide facilities, election judges, and other resources to conduct their elections. A township clerk from our county recently told me that their township identified $40,000 in necessary repairs to make their 1890s-era town hall compliant to repair the roof, just to use it for voting. This is not a unique situation in this county. Several other cities and towns have issues with their facilities as well. These municipalities often conduct a few elections per year. These include annual March township elections, state primaries, generals, and state and even municipal special elections in some cases. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to this committee about this great option for conducting elections in these small communities.
Thank you, Mr. Larkin.
Are there any questions for the testifier? Any questions? All right. Thank you, Mr. Locken. Do we have any other members of the audience who would like to testify on this bill? Yes. Seeing none. All right. Then, are there any additional comments, Chair Dean, that you would like to make?
No, Madam Chair, I would just renew my motion that this be laid over for possible inclusion.
All right. Hearing no further discussion, all those in favor of laying over the bill for hearing no further discussion, we're going to lay over the bill for possible inclusion. Thank you very much, Chair Dean.
Okay, I'm back.
next up on our agenda is House File 1941. Representative Bernardi, please come forward. While you're coming up, is there anyone who would like to make a motion to approve our minutes from what date? Since from March 6th? Vice Chair Bonner, did you move the minutes?
So moved.
That's okay. The minutes have been moved. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, nay. The minutes are approved. Please present your House File 1941.
Thank you very much. And I want to let members know that I am here on behalf of John Lesh today. He is in court and is not able to attend. And I have been a part of...
not as a defendant.
Right. Oh, yeah. Right. Exactly. He is a lawyer.
Sure.
Yeah, right. Good point. And I've been a part of this national popular vote, trying to get this enacted for a number of years now as well. So anyway, today what we bring before you is what's called as a national popular vote. Go ahead.
Would you like to move it before
us? Oh, sure.
And it will be laid out for possible inclusion.
Thank you. So, and you're going to have to remind me of the bill number again.
1941.
1941,
okay.
It was
a great movie. Back in the
day. Right, there you go. It should be easy to remember then. So I'd like to move House File 1941, please.
To be laid over.
To be laid over for possible inclusion.
Okay, please proceed.
Okay, thank you very much. So this is an agreement, compact with other states, I'll just do briefly because I've got the expert here with us, our Secretary of State, Steve Simon. But what the bill basically does is... people who are states that are part of the compact who have the majority, getting a majority of electoral votes to combined, would all agree to put their electoral votes for the person who gets a national popular vote. So that's in a nutshell. And I'm going to pass it over to Secretary Simon.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Steve Simon, Minnesota Secretary of State. Thanks for your time. I know you have a lot of bills. I'll try to move quickly. I want to thank Representative Bernardi for filling in. I want to thank and her longstanding support and Representative Lesh as well for his chief authorship. To me, this is something I've been passionate about for a long time. I used to carry this bill, actually. It boils down to one central principle, and that's in the world's greatest democracy, the second-place vote-getter should not be President of the United States. I don't care who it is. I don't care what party. So I just want to get this out there on the record right now. For me, this has nothing to do, nothing whatsoever, with the 2016 election. I want to be clear. President Trump won the election legitimately and according to the rules in place. I want to make that extremely clear. So I've been for this long before anyone thought that Donald Trump would ever run for president. We have anything like 2016. In fact, just to clarify and hopefully legitimize my own passion for this bill, I remember working. So I worked in 1992. I'll just get this out there. I worked for the Clinton-Gore campaign. I moved to Little Rock, Arkansas, and worked for the Clinton-Gore campaign. And when I first got there, Bill Clinton was in third place. Ross Perot was in first place in the polls. President George H.W. Bush was in second place. And Governor Bill Clinton was in third place. And I remember at the time there were people on the campaign that I was working for that were whooping it up because a new poll had come out and shown that, yes, Bill Clinton was in third place, the candidate we were all working for, who's in third place, but no one got to 270, according to that poll. This was June of 1992. And they were saying, this is great, because then it goes to the U.S. House, and guess who controlled the House at that time? The Democratic Party. And I have to tell you, and I don't mean to say this as being on a moral high horse or anything, but I truly was appalled at the time. I really was. I didn't want to win that way. I didn't want to be third place and be President of the United States. That wasn't right to me at that time. And that was before Bush v. Gore. That was before, obviously, the 2016 election. And so that's where I'm coming from on this bill. So this would use the Electoral College. It would not get rid of the Electoral College. It would not even amend the Electoral College. It would use the existing Electoral College, untouched and unscathed, and it would ensure that the top vote getter gets to be President of the United States. So basically, Minnesota would agree to award its electoral votes to the winner of the national popular vote, but it would only kick in if enough states adding up to 270 electoral votes also did the same thing. So we wouldn't be doing this alone. We would only do it if enough states, if a critical mass, agreed to do this. Now, I think the key thing to remember, in my judgment, is that, remember, the U.S. Constitution creates this thing called electoral votes. It says all the states get them, but it is silent as to how the states allocate them. In fact, it says the legislature gets to decide how to allocate the electoral votes. So nothing in the Constitution, nothing, tells us how we ought to do it. It's silent. It just so happens that, by tradition, 48 states have chosen to do a winner-take-all system, including us. Maine and Nebraska are the only two that do it differently. They do it by congressional district. But all 48 states, the rest of the states, have done as we have done, which is said if you win Minnesota by one vote, you get everything. You get all 10 electoral votes in our case. And that's just a tradition, but that's not mandated in the Constitution. The Constitution only says we'll have this thing called an electoral college. We're going to apportion them based on population. States, allocate them any way you want. So if, for example, Minnesota wanted to allocate its electoral votes on the basis of the tallest candidate, we could do that. Silly, but we could do it. If we wanted to say the candidate with the most letters in his or her last name, we could do it. Totally constitutional. Absurd, ill-advised, but we could do it. The point I'm trying to make is that the Constitution is silent. It leaves for the states the determination about how to allocate them. So this just takes advantage of that to do it in this way and allocates our electoral votes on the basis of who wins the national popular vote. So again, it would only kick in if 270 electoral votes worth of states also did this. So far, 12 states adding up to 172 electoral votes have already done this. So this movement is halfway there. 135 was the halfway point. It's 172. I would say there's a side benefit, although to me, some people are motivated by this. I'm not particularly, but if it motivates you, great. I think one side benefit of national popular vote, it would result in true national campaigns. Candidates would have every incentive to campaign everywhere around the country, not just in five or six swing states. So, Republicans would campaign all up and down California, and Democrats would campaign all over Utah and Idaho and Texas. They wouldn't just leave them anymore because they didn't think they could get 50% plus one. They would campaign everywhere. They would be truly national campaigns. So to me, it comes down fundamentally to first principles. It's hard for us to say to the rest of the world, as we do and should do, that American democracy is something to emulate. I think it is. Except this is one troubling exception to me, that when we say to people in Iraq or Afghanistan or Germany or France or Australia that we believe in democracy, but we tolerate a system where the second place vote getter can become President of the United States. Again, this isn't about the current occupant of the White House. He legitimately is our President of the United States. He won by the rules. He campaigned according to the rules. It's nothing to do with that. But going forward, I think It would be troubling if we had more and more recurrences, regardless of who the party is, regardless of who the occupant is, of someone who is the second place vote getter being president of the United States, and it's more and more likely to happen. So that's why I think this is a really smart solution to that problem for our democracy. Thank you, members, for your time and attention.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Any questions for the testifier? Yes, Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned there are 12 states who have currently passed this. Do you know what states those are?
Oh, I thought you might ask that. I don't have that. Maybe Representative Bernardi has that.
It is. It's been enacted by 12 states with 172 votes, including four small states, Rhode Island, Vermont, Hawaii, and the District of Columbia. For medium-sized states, Connecticut, Maryland, Massachusetts, and Washington State. And for big states, New Jersey, Illinois, New York, and California. Others, and just to let you know, 11 additional states with 89 more electoral votes have passed in at least one house or have approval by both houses, such as in Colorado and New Mexico, in the Oregon House, Arizona House, and Oklahoma Senate. So there's additional states that are moving towards adopting this.
Representative.
Mr. Chair, thank you. So do you happen to know the electoral makeup of those states typically?
I don't.
In terms of presidential elections?
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, I mean.
Okay, excuse me. Are you talking about the ones that have already enacted
yeah,
it?
Yeah, the 12 okay. states that have passed it.
You mean how they vote for president? Is
correct.
That your
yeah.
point?
Yeah.
I mean, I think that it's fair to say the ones that have passed it so far lean Democratic. I think that's fair, but not unanimously and not always. I think that's fair to say.
Yeah. Representative.
Thank you, Chair Dean, and thank you, Secretary Simon. That was my assumption as well in looking at those states. Just a couple of comments about this. I think, this idea, this issue has been passed around for years, both pros and cons, and in sort of a bipartisan way, actually. Yeah. A lot of Republicans have supported it at different times. Democrats have supported it at different times. Vice versa, there's been similar opposition. I happen to come down on the side not favoring this, and I just want to explain a couple of reasons why, because I think it's really critical to have the opposing viewpoint out there as well. Number one, I often hear this argument that if we move to national popular vote, that this will nationalize our campaigns, and that this will force organizations to campaign to everyone, because they need to attract all the votes. I would argue, however, that there's a real danger in campaigning to areas with high concentrations of votes. The majority of the population of our country is made up is housed in very few cities, actually. And I think that there's an argument to be made that a national popular vote would really concentrate electioneering to those very densely populated areas. And just to add to that point, you know, there's a reason that in the United States Constitution, every single state gets two senators. That's not, the math is not fair on that, right? I mean, we have states with one at-large congressperson, but two senators. So the math is not good on that. But we do that for a really important reason. We do that to protect us from the tyranny of the majority, to protect those who may be in smaller states from the tyranny of those densely populated states. It gives them a voice. And I think that this issue is very similar. This issue, the national popular vote, forces those states with smaller populations that may not be an interesting target because they have so few voters. They're not important anymore. They don't have to campaign to North Dakota and South Dakota and Wyoming I think, does Montana just have one? I forget. Yes. Yeah, they just have one at-large congressman. I mean, there are a lot of states that just have one, and I think there's a real disincentive then to listen to those voices. So that's just my two cents. I just want that as part of the conversation.
Sure.
Thanks, Chair Dean.
Thank you, Representative New. Would you like to comment to that?
Well,
Mr. Secretary?
Mr. Chair, I appreciate that, Representative New. You're right. This really, I remember the last roll call when I served in the House. It was not that partisan. I mean, you had people, I used to joke, Majority Leader Winkler was in here, and we used to kid about it because we represented two halves of the same Senate district. He opposes this, or did then. I don't know if he still does, but he did at that point. So it was there was bipartisan support, bipartisan opposition. My only response to that is this. I get your point. I think it's an intellectually honest point you're making. But I would say this. If we were to design the Minnesota system like this, if we were to have kind of a mini electoral college, and let's say we did it by county, that's an easy unit. You know, Hennepin County would have almost a quarter of the electoral votes. You win Hennepin County, you'd be halfway home. That's it. All you'd have to do is win Hennepin County by one vote. You'd be halfway home. So I think, you know, if we were to, I think we also need to be honest about the pitfalls of this, too, of this kind of system, and about kind of whether it's a good look, so to speak, to have, regardless of the personalities. We're caught up, I understand, in current occupants and recent elections, but going forward to people who are not yet born even, does it look good to, on a recurring basis, have the second place winner? And it, we could easily, all of us, imagine electoral scenarios where you have someone who wins, who loses badly in the popular vote by like many, many millions of votes, being president of the United States. That's a problem. I see that as a problem, notwithstanding your very intellectually honest point. I think reasonable people can disagree on this, but that's at least where I come down.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. And I'm going to chime in here a little bit. I often don't do that as the chair of this committee. But I think your point is well made, Representative New. And I also want to add on top of that, though, that when we consider these larger markets, the cost of media is very, very extreme. So in some ways, some of the smaller communities that often don't get any media attention, it will make economic sense, I believe, for those candidates to do a balanced approach to make sure that they're getting some of those larger population in some media markets, but also making sure that some of the less dense parts of our country that have populations, we all know that in the end we look at what is the return on investment per vote. That's going to be an important critical piece for that calculation. So I think there's sort of two sides to that argument. And, I'll set aside my point of view on how I feel about national popular vote to make sure that we have the questions and the discussion that we need to have today. I would have one question for you, Representative Bernardi or Mr. Secretary. So in this scenario, and I'll use Minnesota as an example because that's the easiest example because I think most of us know Minnesota. Minnesota actually votes for the person that comes in second in the popular vote. Mm-hmm. Then if the compact is enacted, we have the requirements of the 270 equivalent electoral college votes. That would mean that our electors would then vote for the person that won the national popular vote, not for the person that won the Minnesota vote. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay. And then if you could just sort of go a little bit into this, what the next election in the state of Minnesota looks like when candidates have to go out to voters and say that we realize that you voted for the second place or the, you voted in favor of the person who came in second, but we voted in the end for the one that won the national popular vote. And I think of this because just the other day we passed the administration bill and we made it very, very clear that the person that receives the most votes wins the election in the state of Minnesota. So if you could just speak to that a little bit,
sure.
I think that would help us all.
Right. I think the idea is in a world where this compact kicks in, this whole idea of who states voted for would, to some extent, fall by the wayside. It would be a truly national election. It would be interesting to know who Minnesota voted for, or Illinois voted for, or Wyoming voted for, but it would be more of a truly national election. So just as right now, there's no remorse or sheepishness about saying, well, I mean, you and I both live in Hennepin County. Well, Hennepin County, you voted for this candidate, but the other candidate won. It would be sort of the same kind of thing. It would be interesting to note who voted based on various geographic lines, but ultimately we're looking at nationally for the one national figure that we all vote on and all have in common, who got the most votes. We do that for every other election under the sun except for this one.
Okay. Thank you. I keep looking to my right, but I don't see any members. Any other questions for members? Yes, Representative Bonner.
So I actually just had a curiosity question. I know we talked a little bit about, you know, disbursements and so forth and where folks live, and perhaps you know the answer to this, Secretary of State, but perhaps not. But I'm just curious if we have any sort of a indicator of how many folks in the country are populated in more densely populated areas versus more rural areas, and how they stack up in terms of numbers. And I guess the reason I'm asking that is because I'm just trying to understand how big of an influence would that be in determining something like a popular vote.
Mr. Secretary.
Actually, I'm going to defer to the chair, who has sort of indicated through pantomime that he might have something to say.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Secretary.
Representative Bonner, I believe it was about 6 or 7 years ago, maybe a little bit longer, that the population in the United States, the larger proportion, actually lives in major cities than in less populated areas throughout the state. So we are at a time in our country where more people live in cities than live in rural parts of the country.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just curious, do we know if that's a large disparity or is it close? Mr. Chair.
Representative Vaughn. By the way, we can actually speak directly to that in the state of Minnesota. I believe our state demographer is in the room. So if she would like, I mean, I know that nationally is the case, and I know that in the recent history that may have changed as well. I apologize. I didn't see you sitting behind me. Please come forward, state your name for the record.
Hello, my name is Susan Brower. I'm the state demographer, and I work for the Department of Administration. It seems like it should be a really straightforward answer, but the way that we define urban and rural shifts all the time. And so what I can tell you is, given a definition of urban and rural that the USDA uses, about 70% of Minnesota lives in a urban area. I'd have to look up the numbers for the U.S., but I know that's the case for Minnesota.
Mr. Chair, and again, I appreciate what Representative New has sort of injected in this debate. It's an important discussion to have, and it's a principled point that she makes. I would just argue that right now we suffer from the opposite attention deficit when it comes to people in densely populated areas. You know, if you are in a densely populated area right now in, say, Texas or New York, you're not getting much attention because Democrats probably aren't going to spend the money in Texas and Republicans aren't going to spend the money, you know, door knocking in Manhattan just because of the cost benefit. So I think we're all trying to find the right balance here. I come back to the first principle, though, that is with any election for any other office that I know of in America, first place vote getter wins. And especially for a national office, the one national office that binds us all together, whether we voted for that person or not. It's the one person who we all vote for, the one contest that we all vote for, no matter where we live, and particularly in this country at this time and going forward, where there's a unity deficit, one might say. I think it's important that we emphasize that going forward, the person who wins the most votes, just like township supervisor or governor or state representative or secretary of state, that's the person who gets to hold the office. That's what it comes down to for me.
Yes, Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Secretary of State, I would just like to say, just to kind of put this in perspective, I know we talked a little bit about urban versus rural, and I don't know where folks live in this room, but I can tell you, particularly in my district, out in the suburbs, I can tell you that who folks vote for is not as easily defined based on geographic region. I'd say you really have to work for the votes in my particular district. So I think that's one consideration. But I also just wanted to say that I think you know, and this is just, of course, my personal thought, but it feels like I have a hard time believing that one could win the presidency without winning the heart of America, literally and figuratively. So I think it's a good piece of legislation and a good thought to consider. Thank you.
Thank you. With that, Representative Bernardi, do you renew your motion?
Yes, I'd like to renew my motion that House File 1941 be considered in the laid over to be considered in the omnibus bill.
Okay, we will lay this bill over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Chair Bernardi. And I know that. Oh, okay. Yeah.
In courtesy that are up. Mr. Chair, I was just pantomiming. I could go sit back because I'm on this committee,
yes,
and have the other two visiting members.
Absolutely. We'll have them come forward. Next up on the agenda is actually House File 1371. Representative Long. Welcome to the committee. I will move your bill to be laid over for possible inclusion. Please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Since Minnesota expanded access to no-excuse absentee voting, it has been extremely popular. It's easy to understand why. Voting early lets folks do it at their own pace, to research with the ballot in hand, and to not have to miss work to vote. Over 500,000 Minnesotans voted absentee in the last election. Current law allows county auditors to offer in-person absentee voting the 7 days before the election. With this, voters can fill out an absentee ballot application and voter certificate and then cast their ballot directly into the ballot counter. My bill would simply extend the timeline to the full window of absentee voting and remove the additional step of filling out an absentee ballot application. The double envelope process that we currently have to do for absentee balloting is cumbersome and it's unnecessary in the circumstance of in-person voting. Right now, voters must fill out an application and place it in a signature envelope to be opened at a later date away from the voter. This bill would allow the voter to sign in, similar to how we do now at a polling place, sign the voter certificate, and then receive their ballot. Extending this timeline and allowing voters to cast their ballot immediately gives them the peace of mind knowing their ballot was accepted. When they place their ballot into the counter, they would be notified of any error and could obtain a replacement ballot immediately. This also provides additional flexibility for voters who wish to vote in person. They can stop in when it's convenient for them during the 30 days before Election Day. Not only is this more convenient for the voters, it is also easier on our election administrators. There is less paperwork. There would also likely be a decrease in absentee voting by mail, as more Minnesotans would choose to vote in person. And this would also help with reducing rejected ballots. In the 2018 election, 1,225 votes were rejected because of a lack of a witness signature on the double envelope. An additional 653 voters were rejected because there was no witness, address, or title. So if you combine those two numbers alone, that's six times more than the margin of the Franken-Coleman election. These are voters who acted in good faith to vote, but who did not follow the convoluted procedure with the double envelope process. Totaling all reasons for rejection, 3,595 Minnesotans had their final ballot envelope rejected in the last process. Voting early in person is easy to track. It would be added in the voter record that they have cast an early ballot. They would not be allowed to later vote via absentee or in the polling place. This is the same as voters currently who have voted absentee. So, in conclusion, early voting in Minnesota isn't new. This bill only seeks to streamline the process and gives additional peace of mind and flexibility to voters. And with that, I have two testifiers I'd like to invite forward.
Please have your testifiers come forward.
I'd like to invite up Secretary of State Steve Simon and Andy Logan with the Minnesota Association of Counties. Are you going to come up? Okay.
Welcome back, Mr. Simon. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Member Steve Simon, Minnesota Secretary of State. Well, I want to thank Representative Long for authoring this. And he's picking the baton up. If members who were here last session remember, Representative Fenton had a bill which would have gone even further than this. She would have had this regime in place for the entire 46-day absentee ballot period. So Representative Long sort of somewhat split the difference and said, okay, let's do it 30 days, which seems reasonable to me. I just want to underscore, and members on this committee may have heard the statistic before, but just for the record, this is really, really popular. When the legislature passed in 2013 the No Excuses Absentee Voting, Minnesotans have really embraced it. It used to be around 8% or so would vote absentee when you had to provide an excuse and sign an oath. This last election that we just had a few months ago, it was 24%, so it's tripled in a few years. I predict that over time that's going to creep up. I wouldn't be surprised if it went past 30% at some point. So Minnesotans really are saying that they don't really want to be told that they can only vote in a particular place on a particular day during particular hours. And this really accommodates that trend. It would allow people not just for the current 7 days. Keep in mind, current law is you can do what this bill says you can do for 7 days. Before the election. This just extends it to 30 days, not as far as Representative Fenton's 46 days, but to 30 days, the time during which someone can go in, vote in person absentee, typically in a county seat, without having to deal with all the envelope mess, which is just an administrative hassle. It's also a hassle for voters. It's more like a game day experience of voting in your typical polling place. And that's really it. I would add one other thing, that for voters with a disability, this is a big deal. For many of them, they have to show up and vote in person. There is a bill pending, shameless plug, that would make it easier for them not to have to do that right now. But until and unless the legislature passes that, many of them, practically speaking, feel that they need to go in person and vote absentee if that's what they want to do and can't do it reliably or in secret from the comfort of their own home. And this would go a long way, a very long way, in accommodating voters with disabilities. I am authorized to say, because they couldn't show up here this morning, that the League of Minnesota Cities also supports this as well.
Actually, turn around. They are here.
Surprise!
I was told I could say that, but maybe I don't need to. So I'm here to answer any questions. But again, this just extends what we already have in law, although not as far as Representative Fenton had last session.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Slide the mic over. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Troy Olson. I represent the Minnesota Association of County Officers. And all of our points have basically been covered, but I just want to emphasize the importance of being able to use the direct balloting process more fully as a efficiency to the entire process. So thank you. That's all we have.
Thank you. Do we have questions for the bill author or testifier? Yes, Representative New.
Is everyone done testifying?
I guess I should probably just open up to the public if they want to come forward and say a few words. We're going to put you on a hard clock of 3 minutes.
No, you should. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Ann Lance with the League of Minnesota Cities. We've all been doing a lot of elections work this week, so I was trying to keep it really minimal. The only thing I just wanted to add to the testimony, so the League of Minnesota Cities has had a policy in place for quite a while to expand the time period of absentee balloting, and one of the reasons is the response they get from voters when they come into the polling place. So when they come in and fill out an application and then receive the ballot and then it just stays in the box in the envelopes, voters don't like that. They want to be able to place their ballot directly into the tabulator, and so that's one of the reasons why our members are very supportive of this bill.
Thank you. Okay, now we'll move. Anyone else? Okay, we'll move to questions. Representative New.
Thank you, Chair Dean. Representative Long, do you know currently if you submit an absentee ballot, do you have an opportunity to retrieve that ballot as well, or once it is submitted, is it done?
Representative Long.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dew, I could answer that, but I believe that Secretary Simon would have an even more accurate answer than I would.
Mr. Secretary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Dew, yes, you can retrieve that ballot. Little known fact, we try to get it out there, but people sometimes don't know that. Yes, you can.
Representative Dew.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Dean. So Representative Long, there was a relatively contentious primary this last year, and there was a lot of information that came out in the last 6 weeks of the election that may have significantly affected, particularly the Democratic primary for governor. What would happen then with this new system of voting if someone were to cast a ballot 6 weeks out and then got some information that really changed their mind on how they wanted to vote? Is there a mechanism in place with this that they could still retrieve that ballot, or have you addressed that issue in the language of the bill? Because those two things seem to contradict.
Representative Long?
Mr. Chair, Representative New. So my understanding is that this would not change their ability to retrieve the ballot. And there is a time limit at which the ballot is irretrievable. But I can't remember that time exactly.
Mr. Secretary.
Thank you, Representative New. Yes, you can, in your hypothetical, at 6 weeks out, you could still retrieve the ballot. But you're right that the closer you get to election day, that's always a risk of absentee balloting, that the closer you get to election day, there is naturally a cutoff. But, yeah, you can 6 weeks out, 8 weeks out, and that was about the timing and the contest that you're talking about. People can retrieve their ballots. It's seldom done, but people can do that.
Representative.
Thank you, Chair Dean. Representative Long or Secretary Simon, can you walk me through that then? How would that work with this new bill? If someone goes in to vote 6 weeks out, clearly their envelope is no longer sealed. They have opened it. They have put it in the machine. Presumably it is counted by the machine. How then will they retrieve that ballot and vote otherwise if they want to do that?
Mr. Secretary.
Thank you. Representative, Mr. Chair and Representative Dew, I see what you're saying. Okay. So the point of retrieval is at the point, exactly as you imply, at the point of unsealing the envelope, or if there's no envelope, putting it in the machine. So, yes. So under current law right now, it's 7 days out. That means you can retrieve it up to day minus, you can retrieve your ballot up to day minus 7. Under this bill, you could retrieve it up to day minus 30. But after day minus 30, you wouldn't be able to do that. You wouldn't be able to retrieve it.
Representative.
Thank you, Chair Dean. Just to be clear, that really changes things. That is a significant change to this bill, and I'm not sure that is being properly addressed here. And I think that is a good reason to be concerned about this bill. I had a lot of conversations with the last author of the bill because I agree that people do like putting their paper in the ballot machine. It feels more secure. And that is certainly what we want in our elections. I think, though, that there's a big pitfall with this, and it's exactly what I've indicated. And that pitfall is that your ballot is effectively no longer retrievable. Actually, let me ask another question, Chair Dean. Is there a mechanism, Representative Long, by which you could choose to keep your ballot sealed up to the 7 days? Is that addressed in the bill?
Representative Long.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative New, I'm not quite understanding the question. If you are going to vote in person, are you asking if you could take the ballot with you?
No.
Representative.
Thank you, Chair Dean. No, currently when you vote early or absentee, your ballot then goes in the sealed envelope where it is then it's stored in a secure location until election day right now. With the early voting that you are proposing, where people can go and immediately put their ballot in the machine, is there sort of a dual track where individuals can also choose to keep that ballot sealed so that they can then still retrieve that ballot, according to current state law, 7 days before the elections.
Mr. Secretary, I'd actually like to ask that question in a very different way. If I do my absentee ballot 45 days out, do I lose the right to retrieve that at day 30, or do I still get to go until day 7 if I'd like to retrieve it, whereas if I go to the poll 30 days ahead of time and do early voting at that 30-day mark, then my vote would not be retrievable. And if you could just answer sort of that.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'll sort of try to ask, combine both questions. To your more immediate question, the answer is yes, under the current language of the bill. But Representative New, to the issue that you teed up, I'm intrigued. I really am. I hadn't thought about this idea of a two-track system to those who want to vote earlier but want to leave open the possibility. I will be honest, I would want to talk with our partners, and that's exactly what they are, at the city, county, and township level, so I don't want to say anything right now on the record, but I'm interested in conferring with them about the workability of such a solution. You know, to be honest, very few people take advantage of that in current law, but that's no reason not to keep it as something that's available to folks, because things happen in campaigns. So I would want to talk with our partners first, and obviously the author. It's his bill, and I would ultimately defer to him, but to see about workability, about that kind of regime.
And I'd just add that I think there is a pretty clear distinction. If I am putting myself in the mind of a voter, if you are putting a ballot into a machine, I think it probably feels to the voter like that is a done deal, like your ballot is cast. And if you have a double-sealed envelope, I think there is, I mean, even though it's not widely used, an understanding that that ballot is going to be open at a later time. So I do think the voter will understand the retrievability, and it's a voter's choice. If they want, this gives them an option. It doesn't require them to vote early, but if they decide that they want to vote early, they're taking some risk that they may not like that vote a few days later. But I think that there are a lot of benefits to voting early that we've seen voters prefer that for all the reasons I mentioned in terms of flexibility and not having to miss work.
Representative Mead.
Thank you, Chair Dean. So just to clarify, Secretary Simon, what I heard from you just now is that the existing 45 days will continue. And someone can go and vote early or absentee, have their ballot sealed, and that will be stored until the election, but it is retrievable until 7 days out, correct?
Mr. Chair and Representative New, correct. Under current law, that's exactly right.
Thank you, Chair Dean. And my understanding of what you just said is that portion would continue with this new statute, or would that change with this new statute?
Mr. Secretary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative New. What would change with this new statute is the date by which your ballot is no longer retrievable. Mm-hmm. So instead of being 7 days before the election, it would be 30 days before the election. But you have introduced a concept, I believe, that is interesting to me. I see Mr. Loken is here. I don't want to put him on the spot. But he runs the show in one of our largest counties, Dakota County. I'm sure he would have something to say about that, as would our other parties at the county and city and township level. So I'd want to see what they say in terms of administering it. I don't want to just sort of impose anything on them that wouldn't be workable or doable. But I'm intrigued by the idea.
Representative New, I want to get to this question. Then we also still have a couple other testifiers. So,
would you like to finish with the testifiers?
No, that might work better because some of the questions might be answered.
Thank you. So I didn't realize there were other testifiers.
That's okay. I believe we have Julie Hansen from Scott County. Is she here? No, I guess it's going to be Mr. Loken. No, I guess we don't have any.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Dean. I think that we've figured out that there is some work to do with this bill. And I guess I would move to table the bill for now to do some more work on this and maybe get some of these questions answered and figure out how this will function moving forward.
Representative New has made a motion to table.
Is that a debatable motion?
It is not a debatable motion. I will move to a vote. All those in favor of tabling House File 1371, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no.
No.
The motion fails.
Not for sure I did.
Mr. Secretary.
I think we have a testifier who might be able to shed some light on this.
Okay, great. If that testifier could come forward. Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Your name and proceed with your testimony.
Again, Ann Lentz with League of Minnesota Cities. Representative New, to your question about creating this two-track system, I mean, what we have heard from our elections administrators is that most people who come into the polling place want that security, as we discussed, as you said, of putting the ballot directly into the tabulator, and they already have the capacity to store the closed envelopes. So if they, if a voter would say, I would like this to be stored until the 7 days prior to the election, I'm sure that in to be able to offer the people who want to put their ballot into the tabulator that option to then also have this dual track, I could see our members being, that would be very workable. Because, again, the biggest concern is the voters' consternation when they watch their ballot get put into envelopes and stored. So if some people want that, that's a great offering. To be able to say to the majority of the voters who come in, go ahead and put it right in, and here's your I voted sticker. I think that that would be workable if that's something the author would be amenable to.
Representative.
Thank you, Chair Dean.
I realize you're doing the work of three people.
So thank you for giving me more latitude than I might otherwise have. Yeah, I get three times, right? No, I really appreciate that testimony, and I guess my question to the author would be, would you be willing to work with that moving forward, just to make sure that we are giving voters all not only the security that they're looking for and the convenience that they're looking for, but also the protection that they're looking for moving forward?
Representative Long.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dewey, yeah, I'd be happy to look into that. I do think it would be a pretty small number of voters who would want to vote in person but also vote with the double envelope system, but I think that if there is a class, then it would be, seems like the cities would be open to it. I'd be happy wanting to talk to the counties as well, but certainly open to the conversation.
Great. Any questions? Okay, with that, we will lay 1371 over for possible inclusion in the elections omnibus bill. We will now move, since Representative Lee is here, House File 2059. I believe that the motion is to re-refer this to government operations. So I will move that House File 2059 be re-referred to government operations. Please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Bernardi, for allowing us to go before you as a member of the committee. And Mr. Chair, I just wanted to bring this bill forward because the upcoming 2020 census, it's near, and it's really important and crucial for us to have the most accurate count that we have for the state of Minnesota to maintain our congressional seats, and also to be able to, you know, maintain the level of funding that we are currently receiving from the federal government. And I believe that it is said that for most of the many federal funding formulas, for every resident who is not counted, Minnesota will lose around $1,500 annually through different funding streams. And so it's really important. And House File 2059 aims to allow for census worker to be able to access apartment buildings. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'll turn it over to Susan Brower, our state demographer, to talk a little bit more about the importance of the 2020 census and why her office and the administration have brought this proposal forward.
Thank you, Representative Lee. Welcome back, Ms. Brower. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, thank you. My name is Susan Brower. I'm the state demographer, and I work in the Department of Administration. So having a good census count is the foundation for a fair democracy. It comes before the voting to make sure that everyone is counted so that we have fair representation in our districts. If the census count is incomplete or inaccurate, these districts will be drawn inaccurately or unfairly, and people living in undercounted areas will have less than their fair share of representation. A complete count also will give the state its best chance of retaining all eight congressional seats that it has today. It's going to be very close again in 2020, just as it was in 2010, and making sure that we have the very best count is going to give us the best chance to do so. In addition, there's all kinds of funding, as Representative Lee said, that is distributed on the basis of a census count, both in terms of federal funding to the state and to state communities, counties, cities, but also from the state to individuals, to counties, to cities. It guides the distribution of funds kind of across various levels of government. And Minnesota leaders rely on these data to make good policy decisions. To the extent that we are able to target groups of people with the policies as intended, it's going to rely on a good census count. So for all of these reasons, we are very interested in ensuring that the count is accurate, the count is complete. Now, why an apartment access bill? Why is this an issue? Why is this a priority for us? There are about 1.3 Minnesotans who live in renter households. That's about 25% of the state who are renters. And the Census Bureau estimated that in 2010, there was about a 1.1 undercount of renters nationally. So if we use that same percentage, it translates to about 15,000 renters potentially that would be missed. Now that's a conservative estimate because we expect that it will be harder to take the census in 2020 than it was in 2010. But that's kind of a baseline estimate that we have. Renter households are undercounted historically because they contain folks who are harder to count with more barriers to access the census form and to understand what it's about, but also because of the physical barrier that a rental apartment building causes when enumerators go out to doors to knock and follow up when they haven't received forms. And so for these reasons, we're looking to improve access to renters as one of as an important way to improve our overall count.
Thank you, Ms. Brower. Any questions or comments? Representative New.
Are we done with the testifiers?
I believe so. I don't see any other testifiers on the list.
Great.
So,
Thank you, Chair Dean. Representative Lee, it sounds like there was a similar bill, House File 1644, that was passed in government operations yesterday. Is there a reason that we're moving two very, very similar bills through this process?
Representative Lee.
Mr. Chair, Representative New. So this proposal came from the governor's office, and I believe that the bill that you're referring to is Representative Long, and that's a bill that's being crafted by the larger community having different stakeholders and different nonprofit organizations.
Representative New.
Thank you, Chair Dean. So there's just two bills because there's different groups who want to have their own bill? Is that what I heard?
Welcome to the Minnesota State Legislature.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative New, like I said, this is a proposal that came from the governor's office, and so I can't really answer your question with regards to Representative Long's bill, but I believe that his bill is comprehensive and larger, and they have some funding mechanism, and for this one, it's specifically focused at having access to apartment buildings.
Representative New, and then I think there's a friend to phone out in the in the audience as well, but go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Dean. Representative Lee, I'm wondering, anything involving census, there's nothing currently in election statute in 211B regarding censuses. Why are you moving to put this language in the elections statute?
Mr. Chair, the demographer will be able to answer that question.
Please proceed, Ms. McCall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, it's very similar to the allowances in that bill for candidates to access renters, and so it was seen as the census is kind of the precursor to fair and equal elections, it's seen as just an extension of that law that allows candidates into renter households during campaigns.
Representative.
Thank you, Chair.
We're going to try to wrap up.
Yep, last comment. Thank you, Chair Dean. I appreciate that, and I can kind of see where that's going, but censuses are certainly used far more broadly. I am a genealogist, and so I love census records. They're a wealth of information in discovering our families and our ancestries. So it's just a little confusing that it's in this statute, but we'll see what happens.
Okay. Thank you, Representative New. Any other questions from folks? Seeing none, I'll just make a statement as I think the person that has one of the most apartment units in their district. I think that this is something that in some ways is a little bit unique to many other states, that we allow candidates the opportunity to have access to every door in our state versus just those single-family doors that exist out there. So I think that this is actually well-placed in an area where we already have the language in place that allow candidates in to just expand that to census workers. So with that, I will renew the my motion to re-refer House 2059 to Committee on Government Operations. All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed, no. The motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
On your way. Thank you. And I believe that now we're going to move to House File 1818. That's you.
Okay.
Come on down. Come on, Bernardi. Welcome back to the testifiers table, Representative Bernardi, and I believe you're going to want to lay this over for possible inclusion.
Yes, I would like to make that motion, Mr. Chair. Would you like me to say the exact bill number, or do we have a
it's
good
bill number 1818.
I'd like to move House File 1818 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the...
Great. Welcome. Please tell us about the bill, and okay. I see you have a testifier as well.
Yes, this is a very short bill. And what it does is it allows a municipal clerk to authorize to conduct absentee balloting under this section. And what it right now, well, just the long and short of it, you can open up absentee balloting voting places not for a shorter period than 46 days. That would be probably the easiest way to explain it. That's what it is.
Welcome back, Mr. Secretary, if you'd like to add anything to that.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Steve Simon, Minnesota Secretary of State. Exactly as Representative Bernardi said, right now we have an all-or-nothing rule in Minnesota, which is pretty brittle and inflexible when it comes to the ever-popular absentee voting period, meaning during the 46 absentee ballot period, any jurisdiction running an election, a county, typically counties, but sometimes cities, you either have to have a polling place open for absentee voting the entire 46 days or not at all. You can't have any flexibility. And we've had call, particularly from rural counties in this state. Cass County and others have come to our office repeatedly over the last few years saying that's unfair to a lot of their residents, that there are residents, whether it's voters with disabilities, whether it's people who live far away from the county seat, who want to vote in-person absentee but don't want to take a half day off from work. They want the flexibility, let's say in Cass County, to say, yes, we'll always be in Walker at the county seat, but in, you know, week one of the absentee period, we're going to have a station available at the community center in this township, or in week two, we're going to be in this city at the northern end of the county, and we're going to be in the city hall there. They want to have that kind of flexibility, and they don't have it now. They've got to either commit to have a station open the entire 46 days or not at all. And so this would just provide that flexibility. There's a real call for it, particularly in rural Minnesota, where they want that flexibility. So that's all it does.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Do we have any other testifiers that would like to speak to House File 1818? Please come down, Mr. Olson. State your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Troy Olson, representing the Minnesota Association of County Officers. And I just want to echo the theme of flexibility, and that this bill, 1818, will give us that flexibility we need to better serve our voting public. And I also want to mention that the League of Minnesota Cities also feels the same way.
Thank you,
Representative Bernardi. Yeah.
Okay, any questions for the testifier? Okay, seeing no questions. Representative Bernardi, do you renew your motion to lay this over for possible inclusion?
I do, Mr. Chair.
Okay. This 1818 is laid over for possible inclusion. Okay, up next on the agenda is House File 2050, and I believe that is Vice Chair Bonner's bill. You can grab the testifier stand and move your bill. I believe that we are going to lay this over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Would you like to make the motion or you want me to?
Thank you, Chair Dean. I would like to make a motion to lay over House File 250 for possible inclusion.
I believe it's 2050.
2050?
Oh, and that motion is heard, and do you have any amendments to 2050?
I believe I do. Yes, I'm sorry, Chair Dean. I would like to move the technical amendment on 2050.
And what is the number of that amendment?
Is it? Sorry, Mr. Gehring. Is that the 19-3427?
Mr. Bonner, no. So the amendment where's that I drafted for you this morning is labeled A1. It's the, I think there are copies at your...
I'm sorry, I don't think it was in the packet that was handed to me.
Well, Chair Dean, was that... I'm sorry, Chair. Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Moon.
Was this amendment posted by the deadline yesterday?
I'm scrambling right now.
Yeah, we're unaware of an amendment.
We have amendment House File 2050 A1. Do we know when this was posted? Oh, it was posted this morning at 8:39. And I am now seeing this for the first time, so I'd like to really wonder what's in this.
Yeah.
And then if there are some things that you may have objection to, this may have to come forward when this piece may appear later in the larger committee bill.
Mr. Chair, may I suggest, may we have a recess for 10 minutes just so we can go and review and see how this fits in the bill?
Yeah, I'm good with taking a 10-minute recess.
And is there a copy of that for us?
We will make sure that there's a copy for you.
Thank you.
So we are in recess for 10 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, welcome back, folks. We will reconvene this meeting. And Representative Bonner, to your amendment of House File 2050.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would like to move the A1 amendment.
Okay, the A1 amendment will be moved, and I believe this did not meet deadlines, but I believe we're going to make an exception to allow this to be incorporated today. So all those in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Okay, the bill is in the shape in which you want it. Please proceed.
Thank you. All right, and thank you, members, Mr. Chair, for the indulgence on that. I know this bill is really a lot about transparency, and we certainly don't want it to be about exclusion. So that said, Mr. Chair and members, I want to thank you today for allowing me the opportunity to introduce HF 2050, the electioneering bill, often referred to as the Sunshine Law. Fair elections are really the cornerstone of our democratic process. As a deep patriot, I believe that democracy works best when citizens are able to choose for themselves the candidates that truly represent their values. As we know, the 2010 Citizens United versus the Federal Elections Committee decision fundamentally changed the way that our democratic process works by opening the floodgates of influence of special interest groups that could really wield wield their powers of persuasion in the elections. In essence, by buying influence without being transparent as to who's behind these efforts and clearly allowing the public to know their agenda, in the years following, we've seen a number of groups take advantage of this void in transparency that's been left behind. Current law often allows for special interest groups to get around disclosures by practices that clearly skirt the will of the people. For example, special interest groups may go around current law by simply avoiding words such as vote for or vote in their communications, be that literature, media, et cetera. Under these rules, they do not need to disclose who paid for the ads, yet they clearly intend to sway your vote even without the presence of the words vote or vote for. And it's my belief that Minnesotans see through this, and more importantly, that Minnesotans know better. My small race in Maple Grove garnered a great deal of distinction in being fourth on the list of independent expenditures in the state of Minnesota. In this previous race, and my colleague, Representative Ginny Cleaforn, had the dubious honor of being the top of that list. In essence, we have an influx of outside money going in to influence state races in an attempt to sway our vote. Minnesotans are good common sense people that know this practice is simply not fair. Often I would hear voters at the doors who were really disgusted by some of the negative attack ads, both for and against myself and my opponent, quite frankly. And it was clear that the voter could not distinguish between ads that were coming from the candidate and those coming from special interest groups. And it doesn't take a strong moral compass to know that this is wrong. While we all understand that the Constitution guarantees the freedom of speech and groups have the right to provide information that supports their priorities, voters have the right to know who's influencing their vote. Voters need information to make an informed decision in a fair and honest way. This aligns with who Minnesotans are fundamentally, and it speaks to our values. I think we all know that this is simply not acceptable, that there is more information provided on the plastic bag for a Happy Meal toy than we provide to voters in order to make their decision that impacts the democracy, and it's time for change. HF 2050 seeks to shine a light on special interest spending by requiring greater disclosures of contributions and their source, and in some small measure begins to right the wrongs left by the Citizens United decisions and restore the public trust in our democracy. Our Constitution begins, "We the people, in order to form a more perfect union." Nowhere in that language does it say anything about we the special interest groups. Members, I want to thank you for allowing me the time and opportunity to present this bill before you today and take one step closer to transparent, democratic, and truly true elections.
Thank you, Vice Chair Bonner. I believe you have a couple testifiers.
I do.
Okay.
Yep.
Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Yes, my name is Michelle Witte, and I'm the Executive Director for the League of Women Voters for the State of Minnesota. And thank you, Chair Dean and members of the committee, for letting me testify today in favor of House File 2050.
The League of Women Voters is about to celebrate our 100th year of promoting informed and active participation within our government. And while many things have changed over this last century, our commitment to working for fairness and transparency in elections has not. LWV Minnesota has a strong position that while voters should receive sufficient information about candidates and campaign issues to make informed choices, they should do so with full transparency and the right to know who is using money to influence elections. So House File 2050 helps to fulfill these shared principles with the League. Yes, get involved, support issues and candidates, but simply disclose who you are and how much you're spending. There should be nothing to hide. So as an example today, I'm taking time here today to share my testimony with you. I'm a registered lobbyist with my nonprofit, nonpartisan LWV Minnesota. I will disclose in my campaign finance report that I'm talking to you here today. I will apportion my appropriate salary and expenses on my report. I'm happy to disclose and be on the record that I and the organization I work for care deeply about the integrity of our election system. And therefore, we choose to spend a portion of our direct time to educate you here in this hearing, to lobby you, in effect, to ask you to please consider the information and evidence we're sharing with you today so you can make a fully informed decision on how to vote on this piece of legislation. That example is essentially what this bill does, is give that opportunity for voters to be fully informed as to why people are spending money or time on an issue in the concept of political ads. It helps to further qualify that true transparency means taking into account any time or functional equivalent, as it says, you act to support a candidate for public office using any words that ultimately support or oppose a candidate do qualify as campaign expenses and should be disclosed to the Campaign Finance Board under Minnesota law. It also applies to electioneering communications, or those communications that mention a candidate within a short period before an election. Currently, electioneering must be disclosed to the Federal Election Commission for federal races, but there's no similar law in Minnesota. This bill would extend that same transparency to Minnesota and Maple Grove and others and ensure that political action committees don't avoid disclosure laws. We talked about the magic words, you know, things like being able to say, vote for me, don't vote for me, instead of saying, oh, make a change this December or this November. So again, we often feel PACs should disclose their political ads, and that all of that, if it looks like a political ad, walks like a political ad, it probably is a political ad. But lastly, I do want to say you really are on very solid ground here, because in voting yes on this bill, the disclosure of who funds electioneering communications and how much is spent is required by law for federal races, as I said, according to the U.S. Congress. And the constitutionality of this law was actually upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court Citizen United case. So where actually 8 of the 9 justices at that time all concluded that, yes, there should be transparent disclosure of who funds electioneering communications and how much money is spent. So, however, that same standard does not apply here in Minnesota for our local races. People have a lot of feelings about Citizen United, but there was one area of agreement, and that transparency in election expenditures is a constitutional standard that should be upheld at all levels of government. So thank you for taking the time to learn more about this issue and the important issues of full disclosure to all voters, giving them the opportunity to make informed choices without the hidden influence of money or undisclosed intentions.
Thank you, Witt, and we'll now have another testifier. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Jeff Sigurdsson. I'm the Executive Director with the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. The board has not taken a position on this bill, and I won't be testifying either for or against it, because the provisions are in Chapter 10A. I am here as a resource for any questions that may be more technical in nature.
Great. Thank you for being here, Mr. Sigurdsson. Are there any other individuals in the audience that would like to speak to this bill? If not, I will open it up to member questions. And Representative New, you get the first one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are a lot of questions for this bill, but I appreciate, Mr. Sigurdsson, you explaining that. I actually was going to ask, and maybe we can just clarify. I actually spent a lot of time looking over the recommendations from the Campaign Finance Board, and there was one small section of this bill that it looks like was very similar to one of your recommendations, but you are not endorsing the rest of this bill then? You are neutral on it. This is not your language. You did not ask for this.
Mr. Sigurdsson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative New, not a simple answer. The majority of the language in this bill was, in fact, developed by the board in 2013 and was a legislative recommendation from the board at that time. It was brought to the legislature in 2013, 14, and 15, and had some success, but frankly was never passed. At that point, through both the change in board members and in their interest in finding, you have to remember the board is a bipartisan board, so I have three Republicans and three Democrats, and so in their discussion of what they believe they want the legislature to focus on, you are correct, if you, on page one, sections or lines 1.13 through 1.16 is in fact very similar, not exact, but very similar to the current board recommendations, because the board also agrees that there is many examples of communications that are not using the so-called magic words, but from any reasonable person standard, which is a term that has been endorsed by the U.S. Supreme Court. I don't really think that there's an easy argument to say that it wasn't, in fact, to try to influence the nomination or election of a candidate, and there are lots of examples which I can provide to committee members. And so from a situation of treating all communications that have that purpose the same and being able to, most importantly, be able to provide accurate information to the public on the total amount of independent expenditures made within the state, the board is recommending that that change, a change very similar to what you see in this bill. The other issues, are complicated, and while the board doesn't oppose it, it also understands that in some cases it's important to find consensus on certain issues and then, let the legislature decide its own interpretation on other issues.
Thank you, Mr. Sigurdsson. Representative New.
Thank you, Chair Dean. And thank you. I guess maybe I'll just ask one other question of Ms. Witte before I move on to my questions for the bill author. And Ms. Witte, I'm just wondering, with the League of Women Voters, does the League of Women Voters publish their donor information?
Ms. Witte.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we have. We are required as a nonprofit to file a 990 form where you put your top highest donors over a certain amount on a 990 form that is open to public viewing. So that is something that we have available.
Mm-hmm. Representative.
What is the income threshold for disclosure then? Or what is the I assume it's a donation threshold?
Yeah, I think it's a percent, I believe. It's a percent of your highest donors. So I'd be happy to get that information and share that with the committee. I don't know exactly what the threshold is, to be honest. So I can certainly look into that and let you know what that is.
Mm-hmm. Representative.
Okay. And is that information public?
Yes, that is on our public file, 994.
The 990 is public information.
Yep.
Yeah, Representative New, I believe that most nonprofits are supposed to make that available. Many of them do have it actually up on their websites.
Correct.
Thank you. So I will start with some questions for the bill author. Representative Bonner, you talked a lot about transparency in this, and you used phrases like shining a light, and this is the sunshine bill. And I can only assume that that is referring to what we often hear is called dark money. We hear that term a lot. And so I guess I would just ask, what do you see as that dark money, what's happening right now? What is your definition of that? What do you see falling into that right now?
Representative Bonner.
Well, I can tell you that I don't know that I want to characterize and call out any particular group or organization in that regard. I think, again, this is really about full transparency and that voters have the right to know where their information is coming from, who's influencing their vote, and what their agenda is. And I think that applies unilaterally to any organization. And so having that ability to have that information at your fingertips, I think just makes good common sense.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm actually getting some conflicting information here, and perhaps Mr. Gehring could answer that question. Going back to the disclosure of the 990, do you have that information, Mr. Gehring? Do you know? I'm hearing that they are filed, but those donors do not have to be publicly disclosed. The 990 is filed, but that it's not actually public information.
Mr. Gehring.
The donor list.
I'm sure some of you, I have looked that up. I'm not specifically familiar with the
990. Okay, thank you.
Representative.
So, Representative Bonner, a lot of what you talked about in your opening statements, you talked about independent expenditures and that they have a great deal of influence in elections. And certainly in Minnesota, we know that that's true. I mean, we have very strict campaign finance laws as it regards candidates. We actually are able to spend relatively little money, and so when you are in a targeted district, the vast majority of messaging that is happening in your district is not coming from you. It's happening through these independent expenditures. So I guess I would ask then, how do you see your bill affecting those independent expenditures?
Representative Baum.
Thank you. That's a good question. And I think, you know, realistically speaking, you know, and I don't mean to keep going back to this, but really, I think, and some organizations in those independent expenditure groups do a very good job of identifying who they are and what their agenda is. And I think we all in this room, since we've been at this for a little while, can probably identify who those groups are. They're very transparent. But, you know, in talking to voters, it's very clear that not all groups are as transparent, and that it's often these pieces come particularly in the mail or things that might show up on a television, on cable, or whatnot. And it's not clear who is actually influencing that information. And I know from personal experience multiple times when I've talked to voters and they've said to me, for example, you know, I just really didn't like this negative piece that you sent out. And of course, I look at them a little bit baffled because I can tell you that I know every single piece of literature that I have paid for. I can tell you every single word that is on that piece of literature in terms of what I approved to go out. And in fact, I have often made a very concerted effort to make sure that my language is very neutral because I believe quite personally that for the things that I send out the door, that I want the information that I provide to be about having a conversation with the voter so that they can make an informed decision and not just giving you know, political jargon or rhetoric or talking points. I don't think that really serves the voter in being able to decide who best represents their values. And so it's disheartening to find that voters are getting information from other sources and that it isn't clear who it's coming from. And what I can tell them is that it's clearly not coming from me.
Representative New.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Bonner, what does this bill language do to solve that perceived problem with independent expenditures?
Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative New. And really, again, it's about making sure that it is clear as day, who is behind sending out that literature and what their particular agenda is, or at the very least, that an informed voter could take the name of that organization, go look it up, and find out the real information behind that particular piece of advertisement, and then know what they're getting into. They can know where that's coming from, the agenda of that group, and they can make an informed decision for themselves.
Chair Halverson, I believe you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Bonner, for bringing this bill forward. I've been involved in this effort in the past, and the longer this issue languishes, the more call there seems to be from the public for a better understanding of who is funding these independent expenditures in our elections. And one of the things I think that is incredibly important for us to recognize as policymakers as we debate this is that in the Citizens United decision that essentially opened up a lot of independent expenditures coming into our local districts, there was a very important piece of that decision that actually says that the states will be able to regulate the amount of dark money flowing through transparency and disclosure. And I think that that's incredibly important that the Supreme Court essentially booted it to the states, and a lot of states have taken that on. And so even in that decision, the assumption was that transparency and disclosure were going to be important tools for the public to understand who is funding the money coming into our state. Having been in a swing district since I was elected, I've watched this play out in my own district, and the confusion that it lends to the voter is incredibly unfair. And the other thing that I think is incredibly unfair is that when you represent 40,000 people, the discussion should really be about your community. And it should be driven by people in your community, not from people from outside the state of Minnesota, who have unlimited amounts of money to spend and who don't have to apply to the same kind of standards that you or any of us around the table would have to apply to in terms of disclosing who funds our campaigns. The political parties have to disclose who the funding that they do independently on campaigns, and yet we're going to allow anybody with who makes up a name and creates a you know nonprofit to skirt around those rules and basically skirt around Minnesotans. So I really appreciate you bringing that forward, and I really hope that we heed the words that were from that decision in the Supreme Court and use our power as states to regulate the dark money that exists in our elections. So, thank you.
Representative New.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, going back to these initial questions about independent expenditures, perhaps it would be easier, Ms. Bonner, rather than asking you, I will ask Mr. Gehring if he could clarify the current disclosure of donors for groups who are doing independent expenditures. Do they already disclose their donors, groups who do independent expenditures?
Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, Representative New, there is a process for groups that are making independent expenditures to report to the board, and there is a formula that prescribes sort of as a formula in the law that directs at what level of disclosure they need to provide for receipts of contributions. And actually, I might defer to Mr. Sigurdsson to describe the detail about that process.
Mr. Sigurdsson.
Mr. Chairman, member of the committees, of the committee, but there's sort of two parts to this answer as well. Remember, independent expenditures are not only made by independent expenditure committees and funds. They're also made by party units and typical political committees and funds, which also can make contributions to candidates. In that case, namely regular political committees and funds who cannot receive corporate contributions, and political party units who cannot receive corporate contributions, their disclosure is any contribution of over $200, which is the same as a candidate. An entity that's registered as an independent expenditure committee or an independent expenditure fund, because they can take corporate contributions and the disclosure requirement is recognized to be different, they only start, the first question is whether or not they received over $5,000 from a source. So the threshold is $5,000 over 200 rather than 200. And then secondly, there is an allocation formula where they either identify any individual or association that gave them $5,000 and said spend it in Minnesota. So if it was directly allocated, they have to be disclosed. Or they can basically pick and choose from all of their membership and allocate among all donors to their association as to whether or not they're going to have anyone who gave over $5,000. So, for example, if they decide if they have a base of money of that's sufficient to cover the expenditures in Minnesota and they can allocate $4,999, then no one is going to be itemized. They'll provide a statement saying that we gave $50,000 to this independent expenditure committee, and this is the name of the association. But there is no drill down to the individuals who then gave to the association who gave to the independent expenditure committee, if that was helpful.
Thank you. And Mr.
Representative
Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair. So this question of earmarking, that is in line with Citizens United, that indicated that that if those funds were earmarked for political purpose, that then it would have to be disclosed. Is that correct?
Mr. Sigerson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative New, I would use the word designated rather than earmarked. That has a different meaning in 10A, but the correct, any contribution that's designated, I think that basically the Citizens United was more open in that language. It just said that you have a right to get disclosure on the source of funding for independent expenditures. I don't think they went into the detail that you see in Chapter 10A.
Representative Nick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bonner, are you familiar with the case of Buckley versus Vallejo?
Representative Bonner.
I am not, Representative New.
Okay. Representative New.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this is a really important case because this is the case that brought forward the objective of the bright line test that we currently use in Minnesota. And I don't remember if it was you, Representative Bonner, or Mr. Sigurdsson, who talked about sort of the magic word test that we currently use in Minnesota, using those words like vote for or elect. But these words are really important because they make it very clear to groups that they know how they can advocate in an election. They know exactly what that standard is. And you mentioned that using these words skirts the issue. It's a little concerning to me that by not having a clear definition, we're creating this subjective and vague standard. So I guess my question would be, where will that power now reside? Will that be with the Campaign Finance Board to make the determination on that subjective and vague language?
Representative Bonner or Mr. Sigurdsson, if you'd like to answer.
I guess that question would be to the author. She's determining where this is going.
If you want me to. Mr. Chairman, Representative New, it's hard for me to answer that without giving maybe just a little bit of a one-minute background. And again, this is sort of on the basis that the first section there is, in fact, a recommendation from the board as well. So I guess I feel a little bit more free to defend that language. It is true that Buckley-Vallejo set up the magic word standard, the 8 or 10, depending on how you count it, word standard of this is communications to affect the nomination or election of candidate, and if it doesn't use those words, then it's not. Well, the Supreme Court in subsequent decisions decided that, in fact, that was sort of underestimating the power of the English language and that it is possible to have communication that has no other reasonable person standard. And that was in Wisconsin Right to Life 1 and Wisconsin Right to Life 2, where the Supreme Court, the current Supreme Court, the Roberts Court, decided that that was simply not a workable standard and expanded it to the idea of functional equivalent, where, in other words, there's no other reasonable belief, if you look at the, or conclusion, I should say, if you look at the advertisement, that it is, in fact, to influence nomination or election of a candidate. I will say that this bill then goes to the third piece of communication, which is electioneering communication, which is the one, frankly, that you may be more concerned about. I don't think that there's much doubt about the reasonable person standard because the board would have to say there is absolutely no way that this can be seen as anything other than to influence the election or nomination of a candidate. Electioneering communication is a difficult threshold because it's basically acknowledging that some communications could absolutely be seen by a reasonable person as for some other purpose than to influence the nomination or election. For example, advocating that you contact your legislator to say vote for safer roads, increase funding for the highway fund, or something like that. That's lobbying. If it's done during session, it clearly is not campaign finance related. But under electioneering communication, if that same advertisement is done 30 days before the primary or 60 days before the general, well, now it is campaign finance. related, and now the disclosure to the board is required. So there are the electionary communication tries to put a bright line by using dates. It understands or acknowledges that there are, in fact, some wording that it is possible to have communication that's worded in a way that you can't determine what it's for, and instead we're going to say when it's published or when it's disseminated to the public. At that point, you're going to become electioneering communication or a type of communication that has to be reported to the board.
Thank Representative
you.
New.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So does the Campaign Finance Board have the capacity to review every single piece of election material that comes before them? Or I shouldn't even say that comes before you, that is sent out in an election, in a statewide election.
Mr. Sigurdsson.
Mr. Chair, Representative New, no, and of course we don't currently either. There are lots of communications that are sent out, and the process set up in Chapter 10A is recognizing that a small staff of nine would never be able to regulate 67 Senate districts and 134 House districts and four constitutional campaigns. And so it relies on your opponents to say, okay, or you, to say, okay, here's a communication. Why isn't there an independent expenditure disclaimer on this? Why, when I go to the board's website, is the organization that may have sent this out not even listed as registered with the board? So the evaluation of all the communications doesn't occur at the board. It occurs in the field with the candidates and campaigns who are in fact on the ground.
Did Representative Bonner have a comment?
Representative Bonner?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members, Representative New. I think, to be honest, we're getting a little bit in the weeds, and I want to be really clear that while we talk about specific words, I have to be upfront with you. I think Minnesotans are smart enough to know that there are far more than 8 to 10 words in the English language that are attempting to persuade. I think we all know that. You know that, I know that, we all know that. And again, this, I'm going to bring this back to the point. We're missing the forest for the trees here. The point of this bill is about transparency. It's about knowing where those words come from and the agenda that's behind them. So this is really not about what words they chose to use. It's about who's spending the money and why, so that voters have that information so they can make an informed and intelligent decision about who represents them and their values. And that is really the fundamental point behind this bill.
Mr. Chair.
Representative New.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With all due respect, Representative Bonner, it's our job here in the legislature to see the trees and not just the forest. It's our job to get into the weeds and dig into the actual language of the bill, because words matter. And this is going to have a huge impact on organizations. So I appreciate, Chair Dean, that you have been incredibly kind to us and will allow us to dig into the weeds and talk about the language and see the trees, because that's actually our job here.
Thank you, Representative New, and I hope we stay with the bill.
Absolutely. I'm going to continue with the bill. So with this with the Campaign Finance Board now reviewing these, and Mr. Sigurdsson mentioned, things that come to him, like if there is no IE disclosure, things like this, which are obvious, right? We can tell if there's no disclosure. Anyone who's been involved in campaigns and elections always looks for the disclosure. We all want to see who it's coming from. However, this obviously opens up a much broader range of issues. I guarantee that every single piece of mail now that we don't have that very clear standard, if this language is enacted, we'll no longer have that very clear, bright line standard. I guarantee that there will be a flood of mail or other communications going before the Campaign Finance Board for review. So my question is, does the board have a mechanism in place to deal with that significantly increased capacity?
Mr. Sigurdsson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative New, I mean, I'm responding to a number that I don't know what the number is, but we did have, or the legislature about 4 years ago now, put into a place where we do basically a quick prima facie evaluation, then a probable cause evaluation by the board. The prima facie is done only by the chair, and then we do a full investigation if so ordered by the board. The reason I point that out is that the prima facie investigation or standard allows us to review a lot of complaints very quickly. Now, obviously, if we get into a position where we actually have to do an investigation, then that's, you know, the process slows down. But at least the initial review as to whether or not a communication should be disclosed, I think, could be done fairly quickly by the board.
Thank
Mr.
you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nguyen.
And Mr. Sigurdsson, can you walk me through what that process would be here? Again, right now, your standards are very clear. Does it meet the bright line test? Does it use these words? Does it have the disclosure? There are very specific things you can look for that make that process go very quickly. What would be your new standard, and who would be determining? Would it be a staff member at the board? Would it be the appointed members of the board, where we said, you know, we've got three Democrats, three Republicans? Who would be making that determination at this point on what is electioneering communication?
Mr. Sigurdsson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative New, the initial determination of prima facie is made only by the board chair. Staff doesn't make a determination. We basically format it for review, but the complaint goes directly to the chair. That is, the decision that the chair makes can be appealed by the person who filed the complaint. If the chair rejects the complaint, there is a process where they can come back to a different board member. But at any rate, the second stage, let's assume the chair accepts that there was, in fact, a likelihood, not a determination, but a likelihood that there's something that should be investigated here. It then goes to the board for a full evaluation with all board members voting and with the a party that the complaint is lodged against being able to, at that point, appear before the board and explain why the complaint is frivolous or incorrect or, why it should be dismissed. And at that point, then the full board votes whether or not to continue the investigation. So staff is not, if there's a concern that I'm making that determination, I'm not. The board is making that determination.
Representative.
Mr. Chair, so this process would have to occur with every single individual piece that comes before you with a complaint.
Mr. Sigurdsson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative New, anything that comes through a complaint, that would be correct. Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Representative New.
And Mr. Sigurdsson, does the Campaign Finance Board need any additional funding right now? Are they asking for any additional funding in this budget year?
Mr. Sigurdsson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative New, we do have a change item to our operating budget of $75,000. That is not to hire an additional staff. It's to maintain our current staff. Our budget hasn't been increased, the board has not asked for an increase to our operating budget for 6 years. So this is the first time we've come back and asked for a $75,000 increase to basically account for operating cost expenditures. We have not asked for a complement increase.
And Representative New, just so you know, I'm hoping we have another bill yet to get to, and I was hoping to wrap this up somewhere around 12 o'clock.
Okay, I'll do my best. I do hope, Mr. Chair, that you'll give time on this, because there is a lot of really important stuff, and we talk about the forest through the trees. You know, a big part of this is transparency, which is critical, although I would argue that, you know, there are a lot of ways in which advocacy groups engage in discourse. And unfortunately, the language in this bill seeks to limit and discourage the most transparent form of that advocacy, which is certainly concerning. And we are talking about, you know, we've talked about this disclosure, and we'll get more into this, but, you know, it's very concerning. We've discussed this a lot in different venues, and transparency is for government, and government should be extraordinarily transparent. Privacy is for people, and there are real concerns about that. And with that, let's go on to some different sections of the bill. electioneering communication on page 5, line 5.14. It says by means of printed material. My question is, what about a book? What if there was a book published, and a candidate was discussed in that book? How would that be affected by this section of statute, Representative Bonner?
Representative Bonner.
I'd like to ask our House Research to weigh in on that.
Mr. Guerin.
Mr. Chair, Representative New, I think the way I've described the section is that it's possible that a book could be considered electioneering communication depending on whether it meets the other qualifications here for the definition. So if the book referred to an identified candidate clearly, was distributed within 30 or 60 days for an election, and is also targeted to the relevant electorate, I expect that a person could make an argument that that would fit within this definition. Obviously, if there's a question about that, that would go through the complaint process that Mr. Sigurdsson outlined.
And to that point, if I could just ask the question of Mr. Young. So if a person purchases a book or purchases a piece of electioneering, what would fall under this as electioneering materials, how would that be impacted? Mr. Sigurdsson?
Mr. Chair, I think that Mr. Guerin can certainly correct me. Because the language in 5.13 talks about distributed by as opposed to being on, I would think that that would be more general communication rather than the sale of an item. I wouldn't think it would be included, but frankly, that would be my off-the-cuff evaluation.
Okay. Mr. Guerin, any comment?
Mr. Chair, I would concur with that. The use of the word distribution, I think, would probably be key here. It's possible that an advocacy organization could print some books and hand them out to people as part of a campaign, and that might be included, but if it's for purchase, then that would be treated differently, I think.
Thank you. Representative New.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. So how would that work then? In the case of a book, would the publisher be required to register and file disclosure with the Campaign Finance Board? Would the author? How would that function?
Representative Bonner or Mr. Guerin or Mr. Sigurdsson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative New, I think you're starting to see why the board was concerned about electioneering communication. The answer is if it was being distributed, again, within that time frame and it falls under the other category, then I believe that the association, and it doesn't always have to be, quote-unquote, a publisher, if organization went to a publisher and got 5,000 books and then decided to distribute it during that 30-day or 60-day period, my understanding is that it would be seen as electioneering communications, and they would then have to provide disclosure, not in terms of the vendor who published the book, but the cost of printing the book.
And I believe that Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this is actually a conversation that has been had in our committee in past years as well. And because the bill does lay out clearly, as Mr. Sigurdsson said, what the parameters are, so it's not any old book that you would distribute. It would be clearly within – it contained these parameters, and so it – would be a very limited scope with regard to the content that would be contained in the book as well as the distribution. So,
thank you, Mr.
Representative
Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think with our current language, it's true that it would be very narrow in scope. I think the concern is that with the language proposed here, that blows that wide open, and it's no longer a real narrow scope, and it's quite subjective and vague. And it sounds like we're starting to see some of the problems with the language in this bill. I would move down to line 5.28. It discusses the publishing, and there's an exemption for the publishing of broadcast news items or editorial comments by the news media. And Representative Bonner, who falls under the category of news? What is your definition of the news there?
Representative Bonner.
I'm going to refer to Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonner, Representative New, there's not a specific definition of that term in this bill.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Gehring.
Representative New.
Thank you. So, Representative Bonner, then, for the purposes of this, then, who do you envision Representative Bonner as determining what is indeed news and what is not?
Representative Bonner.
Well, I have to be quite frank with you, Representative New, Chair, members, that I don't believe that I am an expert in determining what is news, nor would I decide that that is something that would be within my purview to be able to provide for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And
Representative Bonner, I agree, and I certainly wouldn't be in that position either. And so I'm just wondering then who would be in that position?
Representative Bonner, Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, Representative New, Representative Bonner, this is another item that, because it's an exception to an oath of selection and communication, I think the process for sorting that out would be, again, through a complaint to the Campaign Finance Board.
Excellent. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sigurdsson, you're going to have your work cut out for you. My next question then related, what if there was an issue advocacy? Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize. What if there is an issue advocacy group who sees a news item or an editorial comment, it says, what if they see that and they choose to distribute that news item? It's that news item. That falls under the exemption, but now the issue advocacy group distributes that. Where would that fall in this?
I'm looking for someone raising their hand. Mr. Sigurdsson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative New, because the piece was then communicated, or I should say distributed by this other organization, they would be responsible for it at that point if it falls under the other parameters of electioneering communications. In other words, I think you could take a news piece, say, see what Representative Smith is doing, channel, in fact, frankly, we see this in campaign advertisements now. Here's a WCCO Channel 5 expose gotcha piece. It's embedded within the advertisement. I don't think the fact that there was some part of the communication that was originally generated by a news agency would change the fact that it would be electioneering communication under this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Sigurdsson. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you said if in part, what if it's not just a part? What if it is the entire communication? The entire communication is simply distributing that news item.
Mr. Sigurdsson.
Mr. Chair, Representative New, at that point I would have to say I think it would be a case of first impression that the board would have to look at to see exactly what it looked like and what was the information included along with the news item.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So theoretically, the exact same piece of information would be allowable by one group, but not another. Sorry, I didn't necessarily ask that as a question.
Theoretically,
this news piece would be allowable by the news organization, but the board would have to decide if that exact same communication would be allowable by another group.
Representative New, I think we're going to get into the weeds a lot here, but I think it's not the exact same if it's being distributed by someone else.
What makes it different?
Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, Representative, just to add to the conversation, there is a dollar threshold here for organizations that don't regularly report to the board, so and that requires some expenditures. More than $1,500 in a calendar year, and so if they're expending less than that amount, then I think they would be required to report.
Sure.
So if they're just literally just forwarding on it, something they printed off of a website that they weren't spending money on it, then that wouldn't trigger a reporting requirement.
Thank you, Mr. Gehring.
And Representative New, I'll just have you look again at the end of the citation on 5.28 and 5.29.
By the news media.
By the news media,
yeah.
Yes.
So the exact same, thank you, Mr. Chair. You're right. So the exact same information cannot be distributed by someone else, only by the news media, even if it is the exact same communication. So moving on to the next page, the voter guide in 6.1, it says that a voter guide is allowable if the guide does not focus on a single issue or narrow range of issues. So am I understanding correctly that a voter guide cannot be based on a single issue? So, for example, Planned Parenthood could not put out a voter guide exclusively regarding their issue of abortion.
Representative Bonner.
I just want to make sure I'm clear on the language in here.
Mr. Chair.
Well, Representative Alderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that, again, we're kind of moving outside. We're not looking at all of the parameters within the bill. We're only looking at, if we're going line by line, it's not a either or, it's an and. And so if a nonprofit group wanted to do an issue-based voter guide, they would have to report, unless they were outside the scope of the parameters of this bill. They would have to disclose what they spend. And honestly, there are a number of nonprofit organizations that, you know, do those kind of voter guides, but they do it as an electioneering communication where they're urging votes for or against. There are also voter guides that don't come out within the timing scope of this bill that would not be subject to those disclosure rules. There are a lot of other rules with regard to how this communication takes place. So it isn't any and all communication. It is very, very targeted within the bill. So it's the ands, not the ors, that you have to look at collectively.
Thank you, Representative Alderson.
Mr. Chair, thank you. So I agree that is completely true, and therefore it's really important to go through each of these pieces and make sure that this is really what we want in law. So I guess I would just ask again, Representative Bonner, would under this section, I mean, it very specifically says that a voter guide is allowable as long as it does not focus on a single issue or narrow range of issues. Again, there are additional things as well, but this is one of them that I think is really important. So, for example, could a group like Planned Parenthood no longer put out a voter guide specific to their issue of abortion?
Representative Fong.
I think it would need to follow the parameters outlined within the bill.
So, no. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, so, Representative New, I don't think that's a no answer. I think that's about disclosure. So, depending on how much money, when the time, and all those other things,
yes,
that would indicate the ability to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But so, excellent. It looks like, as you go further down the page, in Section 6 and Section 7, Section 6 says that a voter guide is allowable if answers included in the guide are those provided by the candidates in response to questions. The
Representative New, could you cite which line in the
bill? Oh, I'm sorry, 6.17 to 6.19.
Thank you.
It appears to me, and I guess I would ask some clarification from Representative Bonner, it appears to me that these two sections, 6.17 to 6.19, section 6 there, and then the next section 7, that those are perhaps contradictory. Section 6 says that answers included in the guide are those provided by candidates in response to questions, that has to be true. The candidates' answers are unedited, et cetera. The next section says, if the guide includes candidates' positions based on information other than responses. So it at least appears on its face that this first section requires that the answers be directly from candidates, and the next section says, but if they're not. So I'm wondering how we reconcile that language.
Representative Bonner, Mr. Guerin.
Mr. Chair, Representative New, so I think the sections 6 and 7 you're referring to there is recognizing that in some cases a guide might have specific responses from a candidate, and in other cases the guide might be based on data collected from other sources. And so they're separated to recognize that the requirements of how that information is presented in the guide might be different based on the source of information. So it's not that you have to have both, it's that it's recognizing that there are two different ways you might prepare a guide.
Excellent. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you. Mr. Gehring, can I ask then, back up on line 6.2, it says that as long as each of the following is true. So meaning that each of these things must be true. So in going back down to section 6, the answers included in the guide are those provided by candidates in responses to questions. So the way I read that is that those have to come exactly from the candidates. Let me just ask to clarify my own confusion then. Is the difference that if questions are asked, and the next section is that positions can be there if not asked?
Mr. Gehring, I think I understand what you're asking, but I'll let him respond and then I'll respond.
And I just asked the question, like I said, because in 6.2 it says that as long as each of the following is true, so each thing has to be true.
Mr. Chair, I'm new, so I think that this may be just a structure of the draft in here that's a little bit confusing, but what's intended here is that the whole series of items from 6.5 all the way through 6.19 sort of assume that the basis of the voter guide is based on questions that are posed to candidates, and so all those things kind of expect that the voter guide is prepared by those responses, and so all those things have to be true. And then in 7 on 6.20, it's recognizing that if it's a case that the voter guide doesn't include responses to specific questions, then this is what you have to have.
Thank you, Mr. Gehring. That's helpful. Mr. Chair.
Representative New.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to jump down to item 5, communication, that on line 6.26 to the bottom of the page. This is specifically referring to incumbent legislators or constitutional officers, and there are some exceptions here that are made. Interestingly, it says, you know, that it's regarding an incumbent of the legislature or constitutional officer. It refers to a clearly identified issue that is before the legislature, and it is made when the legislature is in session or within 10 days after the regular session of the legislature. My question here is, how might this provision play out, Representative Bonner, in a situation like we just had? We had a special election where an incumbent legislator was running for an open Senate seat but still serving in the House. How would this provision apply to that election?
Representative Bonner?
Mr. Chair, Representative New, I'm going to ask Mr. Gehring to clarify the statute.
Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, Representative New, so the definition of electioneer communication on 5.19 and 5.21 extend these requirements to both regular primary and general elections, and also special primary and special elections. And there's not a specific exception in that language for special elections that occur during a legislative session.
Mr. Chair, so can you explain then, like, how that might play out? Does that mean that even though there's a sitting legislator, like, is that automatically considered electioneering if he is just doing his job in the legislature? Or she, of course.
Mr. Sigurdsson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative New, I think the way that language would work is that it recognizes that an incumbent, for example, Representative Rarick, when he was running for Senate District 11, is still nonetheless a representative. So if a communication saying please contact your representative and ask him to do vote for X or against Y. That would not be seen as electioneering communication. Again, remember, these are basically exceptions to electioneering communication. On the other hand, a piece that's done that says vote for or vote against him, or is not referring to specific legislation before the legislature, then at that point it's for communication to influence the nomination or election and has to be reported to the board.
Representative New.
So, Mr. Chair, thank you. Clearly, this goes far beyond at this point, though, those things that we know as electioneering. I mean, we know, when mailings are sent out, radio ads, TV ads, et cetera. The concern here, obviously, would be with the expansion here. And right now, well, let's ask another question. Let's change this a little bit, because I think that this is concerning. What if there is a timely news issue? Something comes up in October of an election year, and a group of legislators wants to hold a press conference on that. It's news. This is happening. Is an advocacy group then allowed to respond to that, or is that response now considered electioneering because of the timing of that communication, even if it is precipitated by something going on in the world? We never know when things happen. Representative Bonner.
I don't know if that's Representative New. I don't know if that's clearly defined here, and this is one of the areas of law that sometimes are open for interpretation. You raise an interesting issue about a group of candidates who may call a press conference during a time prior to elections, and then how would advocacy groups, either one supporting those candidates or opposing those candidates, what they would be able to respond to within that 30 or 60 day, within that 60 day period.
Yeah.
You raise a good question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Halverson.
It is a good question, but the what ifs, really, we have to continue to go back to what express advocating means. And when a communication is taken as a whole is an important piece of the definition, and the proximity to the election, and the limited reference to external events. That is really what we are talking about. So, if we're going to what if things, we can say, okay, what if there was a member of the legislature who's running for re-election who is arrested? Is it incumbent upon everybody to say nothing about that in media, in the press? No. If we are going to use it as an election issue, if there's going to be paid communication distributed to voters in the district in close proximity to the election, that I think under the bill could be considered electioneering. If a nonprofit organization wants to hold the press conference and make a statement, if there is news media coverage about it, I don't see that as being electioneering communication. I, however, am neither Mr. Gehring nor Mr. Sigurdsson. But I just want to be sure that we don't make it more complicated than it needs to be. This is not about limiting communication. It's not limiting the ability to hold elected representatives accountable. It's not limiting the ability to hold candidates accountable. It's holding accountable the people who want to pay for communication and not take responsibility for the communication that they're paying for.
Thank you, Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative New, I know I'm giving you a lot of latitude, and we're about, I think, halfway through the bill. I don't know how many more questions you have on this section versus the following sections. Let's just be considerate with the Friday.
Absolutely, and we all want to go home.
There are some folks that do want to get
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to point out that actually I agree. We don't need to make it more complicated than it needs to be. And this language makes it a lot more complicated than it needs to be. It's currently, the current language is very clear, very concise. Everyone knows the rules. They know when they need to disclose. They know the bright line test of language. This language makes this much more confusing, actually, which is, I think, we're getting to with in this hearing. We're seeing how many question marks there really are with this. I would move on. Let's move on to, you know what? Let's move on to the amendment real quick, since we're in this section of exemptions before I move on to other things. With the exemptions, the amendment, I'm curious, Representative Bonner, did someone bring this language to you for the amendment?
Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative New and members. Yes, I did work with various organizations in vetting this bill, and in particular worked with the League of Women Voters on this particular piece to make sure that, again, that we are being transparent but not exclusionary. And I do have the League of Women Voters here who can also speak a little bit further to that if you like.
Chair Dean, Representative New, any specific questions?
Yes, more questions. Thank you. So regarding the amendment specifically, thank you, Mr. Chair. In the language in line 1.4, a live candidate for forum or host debate, excuse me, forum or debated hosted by a nonprofit. So could groups come together to host a forum? I mean, I know that often the Chamber of Commerce and the League of Women Voters will do a forum together or something along those lines. This specifically says a. So would this bill then, Representative Bonner, prohibit those groups from doing that together?
Ms. Whitty.
Yeah. Thank you. Representative New, it would not. So in essence, the real point here is organizations that do not endorse, support, or oppose candidates. That's the crux of it is, to your point, the idea is to allow groups to continue to be able to host candidate forums, but not those that if an organization were actively supporting or a candidate, that would be something that would have to come through a political fund. So we're trying to make sure those things don't get commingled in the bill, that there's a clear understanding that organizations are still allowed to hold candidate forums. They still disclose, you know, we are the League of Women Voters. We might do them with Chamber of Commerce, which often that happens. But if they are actually, if the organization is also has, you know, an endorsement of a candidate that's sitting at that forum, those ones, they then would have to go through, you know, the electioneering rules and having the political fund. So that's the real difference. I mean, I think in the whole conversation isn't about doing it or not doing it. It's that transparency of doing it and to make sure that nonprofits still can do them, but that you have to, you know, follow these rules, which we've been following for 100 years since we've done them. So we want to make sure that's clear, to your point of adding clarity into the language.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that kind of answers some of the question, but the language is very clear that it says a nonprofit. So Representative Bonner, you'd probably want to look at that language because the way this is written, multiple groups could not do this together. Interestingly, in line 1.6, the forum or debate is focused on a single office. So does that mean, I know that the League of Women Voters in my district does a candidate forum, and we do it all in the same night. So we do a forum, and we've got the House candidates, the Senate candidates. Often we've even got local candidates involved. How do you foresee this happening with this new language?
Representative Bonner, Ms.
Yes, thank you, Chair Dean, and Representative New. Ultimately, just to back up one second to your point, that there actually are a very detailed set of laws on the Federal Election Commission about debates of federal candidates. And so that is one of the things that I put in my testimony, too, that there really is a good precedent for how to manage and balance some of these issues in terms of how you present a candidate forum or a debate. So we believe that a lot of that language is already available at the federal statute to be able to apply here. So some of these specific things here is, you know, I think the attempt was to try to, in this short period of time, bring some of these forward to make sure that people could move forward. So whether it's a single office, again, the big point here, or the whole point of this whole section, is that there needs to be an equal access to all people running for office. You know, whenever you're doing a candidate forum, you need to make sure everybody in that office who is running for that office is invited and to participate according to the rules. So I think that's what it means by an office. So all the people running for that office need to be invited. There's that transparency that we have reached out to everybody, those kinds of things.
Thank you.
Representative New, and I know we have some other members that have questions, too.
Okay, great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I understand the intention, for sure. I just don't think the language is very clean to get to that intention. I would also ask, you know, this is very specific to nonprofits. I know that there are organizations, for example, I know Blue Cross, in fact, it may be in Rep. Halverson's district, is it in that area, Blue Cross Blue Shield? I know that they often bring in candidates to Blue Cross Blue Shield. They do not do endorsements. So Representative Bonner, is there a reason that they would be excluded from this exclusion?
Representative Bonner.
I'd like to clarify, but I believe, Mr. Chair, Representative New, I'm not sure, but is Blue Cross Blue Shield considered a nonprofit organization?
I believe they are. Representative Dean. Yeah.
Yes. They are a
nonprofit. Yes. Thank you, Representative
Halverson. Representative. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what we're saying then is that a large company like Blue Cross Blue Shield could have this exemption, but a large company who happens to not be nonprofit could not get this exemption? And is there a reason for that, Representative Bonner?
Representative Bonner.
Okay. Well, I believe the language also indicates, and let me just pull this in front of me here, but that we're talking about a group that's advocating or endorsing a specific candidate, and to the best of my knowledge, many of those groups are not advocating or for a specific candidate.
Representative New, and then I'm going to move to another
Thank you. Chair Dean, I think the language actually indicates the opposite of what you just said, that it's structured so that it does not promote one candidate. And certainly a corporation would likely fall under that. So it seems like these would fall under all of these.
Mr. Sigerson, do we allow corporations to endorse or do things related to candidates for office in the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Chairman, through an independent expenditure committee or fund, corporations can be involved, and that independent expenditure may take the form of an endorsement, so to that extent they could. I would say that, of course, candidate forums is not a new issue, and the board's perspective is that if you're holding a forum for multiple candidates, you're not making an expenditure to influence the nomination or election of any candidate, which is the definition of a campaign expenditure in Chapter 10A. So I understand the point here is to clarify that candidate forums are not going to be seen as electioneering communication. All I'm just trying to clarify is that currently the board doesn't view candidate forums as something that falls under 10A either.
Thank you.
So to be clear, Mr. Chair, thank you. So to be clear, since this exception is being made, if a group, for example, unions are not nonprofits, corporations are not nonprofits, obviously. So if they held candidate forums, that would be considered electioneering since it does not fall under this exemption. Am I understanding that correctly, Representative Bonner?
Representative Bonner, Mr. Sigurdsson?
Mr. Chair, Representative New, to the extent that I understand the amendment, that may have the unintended consequence of changing that. So there, obviously it's Representative Bonner's call as to whether or not she wants to address that issue.
Representative Bonner.
Certainly, I think that we could take a look at that and make sure that that's clear, because that is certainly not the intent here to allow for undue influence of any group or organization that is endorsing a particular candidate.
Representative Driscoll, I saw your hand up a little bit earlier.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I was just going to say that we made a conscious decision, as Representative Halverson has in the past taken a deep interest in this. On our side, Representative New has taken a deep interest. And so I was going to say thank you for allowing her that opportunity and any question time that I might have had. If she has other questions, I'm certainly happy to defer. It's not that we're having her dominate the conversation because I have questions. She is our resident expert on this matter in the committee today. So if she has any other final questions, I would defer any time that I might have had for a few questions back to her to give her that opportunity to wrap up, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative New, we'll give you a few more minutes here.
Great. I can promise two more questions.
Oh, thank you.
If that helps. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would look on page 7 under targeted to relevant electorate, line 7.20 to 7.21. It's talking about communications from an association specifically. And it says, it talks about communication that is distributed to voters by means of the, oh, whoops, sorry, that's the wrong part that I wanted to target. Sorry, I'm not seeing it at this moment. But some of this would be communication from an association to its members would be allowable, correct?
I believe so, yes.
Representative Bonner, yes.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bonner, then, what if an association sends that communication to prospective members? I mean, perhaps I hate to call it any name specifically, but there are different associations, the realtors. Perhaps they have a list. I don't know how their list works, but perhaps they have a list of all their members who automatically get their communications, but perhaps they have a broader list of all realtors who would get their communication. How does this affect that kind of communication?
Representative New, I would guarantee you that they have a list of all their members, but
I mean those who may choose not to.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know, Mr. Gehrig, if you have a clarification on that.
Mr. Gehrig?
Mr. Chair, Representative New, I'm not sure I might not be following your question exactly correctly, but just to clarify what that language is doing is that in the definition of for determining whether something is targeted to the relevant electorate or not, there are these number of people thresholds. And this is just saying that if an association is distributing communication to their members, they don't have to count that distribution for purposes of figuring out if they've met this 6,000 person threshold.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not about whether they can or can't communicate to their members. It's about whether that communication qualifies them as targeting the relevant electorate for purposes of a communication.
So
that makes sense.
Representative New.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So for clarification, if it's the standard practice of an association to send out communications to everyone who might be a prospective member of that group because they are a logical member, any communication beyond their membership then would count toward that threshold.
Mr. Gehrig.
Mr. Chair, Representative New, so if the list that they're distributing to includes their membership plus then 6,000 more people, then that would qualify as being targeted to the relevant electorate in that district for purposes of disclosure.
So that would then require disclosure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Gehrig. Last thing, Representative Bonner, talking about the disclosure requirements and the statement requirements required for electioneering communication, I would really appreciate, Representative Bonner, if you could just walk me through Section 6 from lines 8.22 to 8.31. If you can walk me through how that is going to work.
Representative Bonner, and just for clarification, you're looking at page 8 from 8.1 through 8.31?
8.22 through 8.31.
I'm sorry.
Yes.
Okay, so.
Sorry, I may have misspoke.
No, that's fine.
Sorry, 8.22.
So the,
that's section six specifically. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonner.
Sorry. I'm sorry. I didn't follow you. 8.22 to
8.31, just that
section. Just that section, yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay. I mean, I guess I'm not sure when you say you want me to walk you through it. I mean, if the language is clear, is there a specific question you have about that section? Is there, Mr. Chair?
I
find the language to be kind of confusing, actually, and I'm just wondering how exactly this would work.
Okay. Representative Bonner. Mr. Caron?
Mr. Chair, Representative New, I might defer to Mr. Segerson. But this section, in general, what it's doing is it's listing out the things that an organization has to report on their statement of election and communication. And this clause 6 that you're looking at is a reporting requirement in the case where an association has spent more than $5,000 of their general treasury money to make the expenditure. And what it's then saying is that if you meet that threshold, so they've spent $5,000 in aggregate for this for a communication during the calendar year, then they additionally have to include in their report to the board a statement that has that identifies the individuals that contributed to the organization's general treasury money that would then get to that $5,000 threshold. So you see the name, address, and the amount attributable to each person must be itemized on that statement to the board. Mr. Segerson, maybe.
Do you have anything to add to that, Mr. Segerson?
Mr. Chairman, no.
Okay.
So
we're going to your third question.
Thank you. Clarification. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this would be $5,000 for a single expenditure, or are we saying $5,000 total for the entire election? I see the words in aggregate, and I'm wondering if it's for a particular piece or if it's for the entire election.
Representative Bonner?
Mr. Chair, Representative New. Mr. Garrick, would you care to comment?
Mr. Garrick.
Mr. Chair, Representative New and Representative Bonner, on 8.24, you see that it's in aggregate for election year communications during the calendar year, so it's not by particular expenditure. It's in total over the course of the calendar year.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative New. We spent some time debating this, which is great, and getting those questions. And I will give you the final word before we lay this over, Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I just want to kind of bring this back around. I know that we got into some of the finer points, and I appreciate Representative New and some of those good clarifying questions. And certainly we did find that there may be some review of the language on the amendment to just make sure that it is crisp. So I appreciate that. Thank you. And I just want to bring this back to saying that I think we are living in a place and a time in which more and more communication comes at us from all different directions. And I think that Minnesota voters really want the ability to understand where that communication is coming from and be able to use that information to make informed decisions. And that seems abundantly clear by the folks that I speak to at the door
continually, and as I know many of the folks in this room do as well. It's really about being able to know where things come from and why we're looking at them. And again, we do this in other places where we're very clear, and it feels that when it comes to something as important as democracy, that this is one area where we absolutely need to have the ability to have that transparency and know where that communication is coming from. So I thank the members for the opportunity.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. Ms. Bonner renews her motion for House File 2050 as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you. We are to our last bill, I believe. And this is a super controversial bill, so I'm expecting that we will probably be here another 2-3 hours. I'm actually joking, folks. Representative Freiberg, please come forward, and I will move House File 1994 to be laid over for possible inclusion. And I believe you have an amendment as well.
Yes, I do. It's the A1 amendment.
Please proceed. I will move that as well.
Sure. Do you want to vote on the amendment just to put in the shape?
Yes, we'll vote on the amendment to put the bill in the shape in which the author would like. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, say nay. The amendment is amended.
Please proceed. Sure, just a point of parliamentary inquiry. I know I was in another committee getting here, but I didn't see in my packet a 1994 an amendment, but I'm just kind of going through the other stuff. If I could just get a copy of that.
Representative Driscoll, we'll try to make sure we get
it. Mr. Chair, it was during the archaeological dig, I did find it, and Representative Chair Freiberg was kind enough to give me a copy.
Okay.
Proceed. I'm so sorry.
No, not a problem at all. Representative Freiberg, to your bill.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. I hope you didn't jinx me by joking that this is a controversial bill, Chair Dean, but I'll plow ahead and just cross my fingers. So several of the laws governing campaign finance in Hennepin County are unique to Hennepin County specifically and are outdated or in some cases conflict with state law. House File 1994 does two primary things. First, it repeals the campaign finance sections of Chapter 383B. Second, it replaces these provisions with either Chapters Section 211A or 10A of the statutes. These changes provide more clarity to candidates, political action committees, and citizens, and it ensures there is appropriate and timely disclosure of campaign finance information. Currently, candidates running for office in cities with a population greater than 75,000 people, and in Hennepin County, that's Minneapolis, Bloomington, and Brooklyn Park, or running for the Minneapolis School Board, file with Hennepin County. Under this bill, candidates running for county offices will continue to file with Hennepin County, but all candidates running for local offices will follow Chapter 211A and file with the local office for which they are running, just like everywhere else in the state. Similarly, under current law, PACs, or political action committees, active in Hennepin County elections or in Minneapolis, Bloomington, Brooklyn Park, or the Minneapolis School District must file with either Hennepin County or the Campaign Finance Board. House File 1994 provides that PACs active in these races must file with the Campaign Finance Board. By doing so, this bill fixes a gap in reporting requirements for PACs operating in these races. Under current law, these PACs, if registered with the Campaign Finance Board, do not file with Hennepin County. So when there are odd-year elections, like those in Minneapolis or Golden Valley where I live, these PACs follow current off-year Campaign Finance Board reporting, which only requires a year-end report. Thus, under current law, there is not sufficient transparency on PAC contributions in these elections. This bill fixes that. With me today are Dan Rogan from the Hennepin County Attorney's Office and Ginny Gelms, the Hennepin County Elections Director, to go over the bill in more detail and answer any questions the committee might have. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Representative Freiberg, and to the testifiers. Please say your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dan Rogan from the Hennepin County Attorney's Office. And in light of the late hour, I'll try to be brief. I think Representative Freiberg identified the primary issues in this bill. Kind of a unique thing about our law here is that it only impacts those limited jurisdictions in Hennepin County. So effectively, the state of Minnesota has three different laws that relate to campaign disclosures and campaign finance, and this one is unique to just those jurisdictions that Representative Freiberg talked about in Hennepin County. What this bill effectively does, or the reasons for this bill are, as he laid out, there's really three reasons. One is that over the past 40 years, there's been changes to 211A and to 10A that haven't been followed in 383B, so we have some disconnect with the other campaign disclosure laws. And significantly, as Representative Freiberg talked about, because of the way that political funds and political committees can either register with Hennepin County if they're going to operate in those jurisdictions, or with the campaign finance board. And if they file with the campaign finance board, then they don't have to file with Hennepin County. And so when we have off-year elections in Minneapolis, the disclosure requirements for those political committees and political funds, there's only disclosure at the end of the year. And so we effectively have political committees and political funds who in a normal 10A election would be disclosing before the primary, after the primary, and in other places they're not doing that. And so it makes an impact on the city of Minneapolis, and that was a change that happened a few years ago that has more recently in the last election become something that was more of a concern. So this fixes that, and it fixes it by not trying to come up with something new, but just trying to eliminate the 383B. So the changes that it does in Section 22, it basically eliminates all of those sections of 383B that were first enacted in 1980 and effectively haven't changed too much. In Section 21, it outlines where the candidates would file, which is that they would go back to filing with their city, and the county's candidates would file with the county, and the school district candidates would file with the school district, which is how that operates in the rest of the state. Political committees, because there was a unique provision here that had political committees and political funds and independent expenditures in those larger jurisdictions all filing with the county, instead of doing that, we just moved that over to the campaign finance board. And as you just went through all the different changes that might be in play for 10A, this doesn't do anything with that. It just moves them over to that, and whatever happens to 10A would be impacted for those political funds and political committees. And I think that the legislature over the past 30 years has made changes to 10A, that have not been reflected in 383B, and that's one of the reasons why we need the change. Then the bulk of the bill, the sections 1 through 20, really just provide changes to 10A to implement this so that it makes it so that those political funds and political committees would understand that they have obligations to file with the campaign finance board. The number of committees that I think it's important for this committee to know that only file with Hennepin County right now, so these are the ones that this really would impact. There's only about 24 of them, so this is not a significant impact on either the campaign finance board or on those committees. And in fact, it provides a lot of clarity to committees so they know where to file. If you're a committee that's operating in the state and in some of those big jurisdictions, you have one place to go, you have one set of rules to follow, and it's easy for you to do that. And we have worked with the campaign finance board on the language, and Mr. Sigurdsson and I have gone back and forth, and they're comfortable with the language. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Rogan. We have another testifier, so I will let her introduce herself and proceed with success for
you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Ginny Galms. I'm the elections manager for Hennepin County. I know we've had a full agenda this morning, so I think my colleague, Mr. Rogan, has covered all the salient points that I would cover.
With that, we will open it up to questions from members.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative New.
My only question would be, Representative Freiberg, have you talked to the campaign finance board, and do they need an appropriation for any additional staff work that this might take, or have they indicated that they can just absorb this cost? What's happening with that?
I have spoken to them. I don't believe that they, I should say they don't, but I know Mr. Sigurdsson's here too, and he can speak for the campaign finance board if you like. But he told me they could absorb the cost.
Great, thank you.
Okay, with no other questions, I understand that maybe we need to, I'm sorry, I didn't see you over there. Representative Rodriguez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just two really quick questions. I'm looking for the amendment. I didn't catch where, what we're doing. Are we laying this over, or is this going to travel on its own?
I was about to bring that up.
The answer is?
The answer is Representative, or I guess in this would be Chair Freiberg, would you like this to be referred back to government operations?
I was thinking it might be worth hearing in government operations okay. also, but if you'd like to include in the omnibus bill as well, that's certainly
yeah, fine well, with me. We need a motion to refer to government operations in order to do that. So I will put forward to refer to government operations. And any other questions individuals
sure.
have?
I thank you for that.
Representative
O'Driscoll. That referral helps me with my second question. Representative Freiberg, is this the Hennepin County statute, like Ramsey has a statute that does govern? That's what we're amending?
Yes.
Representative Freiberg.
Then that's a proper referral. I would concur with that referral.
Okay. Seeing no other questions, no other discussions, we'll take a vote on referring House File 1994 as amended. We refer to the Committee on Government Operations. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and this is re-referred.
Mr. Chair, since our lead isn't here, I just asked the question. Can you give us a little bit of a roadmap of what next week's going to look like?
I was about to do that.
But you're grabbing your gavel, so
no, I'm no, sure but yeah. So for members of the committee, the plan is in the next couple days to put together our omnibus elections bill. We will then have that posted by Monday, and the plan is to come back on Wednesday. And to go through it and vote it out and send it to government operations. So we'll have time for amendments.
Sure, would that be our regular scheduled time, or do you have a time to look at?
I don't know if that's our regular BAT time on the regular BAT channel, but yes, I believe it is our regular BAT time, which is 9:45 in SOB.
And then, Mr. Chair, are you anticipating that because of the need for the omnibus bill that we might have an evening meeting or a follow-on for that? Or?
We will if necessary.
Okay.
So.
And then, Mr. Chair, also Friday, have you got other bills that you're looking at? Because members were told to keep Friday the 15th in their calendar for elections as well. Or is that the date that you would be looking to move to, or any kind of guidance for members because of the theme deadline meeting?
We may. There are still some bills being referred to our committee
okay.
That may not be part of the omnibus bill, which I believe will be taken up on Friday in government operations.
And my final question is, I know I'm standing between the people in adjournment on this.
And lunch.
And many things, Mr. Chair. Travel for some, I understand. So, again, it's going to be that there will be a separate elections bill that will come out of here and then travel on its own as an omnibus bill. With election-related stuff, or is it planning? Are you planning to amend that to another bill?
We're planning on referring to government operations, and they will ultimately make the decision where that bill will be.
Thank you, Chair.
With that, members, we are adjourned.